U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case. And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest.
This week in radical history for the week of October 20th. And starting on this date in 1832, the Treaty of Pontotoc Creek was forced upon the Chickasaw people, giving up 6 million acres. The preamble to the treaty reads, quote, "The Chickasaw Nation finds themselves opposed to their present situation by being made subject to the laws of the state in which they reside. Being ignorant of the language and laws of the white man, they cannot understand or obey them. Rather than submit to the great evil, they prefer to seek a home to the West, where they may live and be governed by their own laws." Also on October 20th, 1916, anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman is arrested for distributing birth control information and released on a $500 bond. Also on that date in 1918, the Anti-Anarchist Act passed by Congress, granting the government authority to deport aliens living in the United States, and it would be the start of the Palmer Raids. During this exact same time in Russia, the Cheka secret police start to round up and imprison anarchists in Russia. Those pesky anarchists. Also on October 20th, 1926, labor activist and anti-militarist and socialist Eugene Debs dies. His radical reforms included an eight-hour workday, pensions, workers' compensation, sick leave, Social Security, all commonplace today. He once ran for president from his jail, and he once wrote, "We propose to destroy the capitalist and save the man. We want a system in which the worker shall get what he produces, and the capitalist shall produce what he gets." Eugene Debs. Also on a date in 1973, the Saturday Night Massacre occurs when President Nixon's press secretary, Ron Ziegler, announces special Watergate prosecutor Cox is dismissed. In addition, he reports that Attorney General Richardson has resigned and Deputy Attorney General Ruckelshaus has been fired. Both of them, of course, did that because they would not dismiss Cox. Bush's Unitarian One Ruler as King loves the jibs of Nixon's cut. Also on this date in 1981, three members associated with the Weather Underground is arrested for the armed truck robbery. The Weather Underground took their name from this Bob Dylan song.
John is in a basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on the pavement thinking about the government. A man in a trench coat, bad job laid off. Says he's got a bad cough, wants to get it paid off. The guy kid, it's something he did. God knows when, but you're doing it again. You better duck down the alleyway looking for a new friend. A man in a coonskin cap in a pig pen.
Also on this date in 1990, 22 cities hold anti-Gulf War rallies. A reporter would also ask U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright this question. "We have heard that 500,000 children have died as a result of the sanctions in Iraq. I mean, that is more children that died than all of Hiroshima. And, you know, is the price worth it?" Madeleine Albright responded, "I think it was a very hard choice, but the price, woof, we feel the price was worth it. You know, it doesn't take a weatherman." This week in radical history for October 21st, 1837, at Fort Peyton, Florida, 75 Seminole chiefs are captured and imprisoned by U.S. during peace talks under the flag of truce called by the United States government. Also on October 1st, 1909, in the city of Brotherly Love, the police chief and other Philadelphia zealots guarding human and civil rights refused to allow Emma Goldman to speak unless they can preview her speech. Frank Rizzo, ex-police chief and mayor of Philadelphia, would say, "Yes, the streets are safe in Philadelphia. It's only the people who make them unsafe." Also on October 21st, 1929, Ursula Le Guin is born. Science fiction fantasy novelist and anarchist. Her books include Dispossessed and Left Hand of Darkness. One of the best modern science fiction and fantasy authors, noted for exemplary style and her exploration of Taoist, anarchist, feminist philosophy, and social themes. Quoting Ursula Le Guin from The Dispossessed, "You cannot buy a revolution. You cannot make the revolution. You can only be the revolution. It is in your spirit, or it is nowhere." Also on this day in October 21st, 1963, Attorney General Bobby Kennedy authorizes wiretaps of Martin Luther King's offices. Also on this date in 1967, Yippies, diggers, anarchists, and other high priests meet in Washington, D.C. for an exorcism of the Pentagon to rid the world of global evil spirit viruses affecting all who work there. The result was 647 arrests. God, it was only so easy. Ever wonder why the mail was so slow? Well, in 1973, Senator Church reveals that the CIA intercepted 28 million pieces of mail between 1953 and 1973. And under the Bush administration? And Bush's old man in 1988 says, "He hears the quiet people others don't." While comedian Albert Brooks was quoted saying, "I have friends in Los Angeles that hear quiet people that others don't, and he takes a lot of medication for it." This week in radical history for October 22nd, 1856, U.S. forces land in Canton, China to protect the American interests. Also on October 22nd, 1887, American Red Revolutionary John Reed lives in Portland, Oregon. Author of 10 Days That Shocked the World, Chronicle of Mexico and the Soviet Revolutions. Though a native-born American, he was denied access back into his own country. Reed is the only American buried behind the Kremlin Wall in Red Square. Also on October 22, 1934, Depression-era outlaw Pretty Boyd Floyd is killed. A folk hero to many people in Oklahoma who saw him as the sagebrush Robin Hood, stealing from rich banks and help the poor to eat and buy them groceries, and tearing up their mortgages during the bank robberies.
If you gather round me, people, the story I will tell about Pretty Boy Floyd and outlaw Oklahoma knew him well. Was in the town of Sony, was on us how to move his wife beside me in the wagon. And in the town they rode. Then my deputy sheriff approached him in a manner rather rude, using vulgar words of language. And his wife, she overheard. Hunter boy grabbed the log chain, and the deputy grabbed his gun. And in the fight that followed, he laid that deputy down. Hills and timber to live the life of shame. Every crime in Oklahoma was added to his name. There's many a starving farmer, the same old story told, how this old law paid the mortgage to save the little home. Others tell you of a stranger that come to beg a meal, and underneath a napkin left $1,000 bill. Was in Oklahoma City on a hippie afternoon, for my whole carload of groceries, and a letter that did say, "You say that I'm an outlaw, you say that I'm a thief. Well, here's a Christmas dinner for the family's only lead.
Last Santa's date in 1975, Air Force Technical Sergeant Leonard Matlovic, a decorated veteran of the Vietnam War, is given a general discharge by the Air Force after publicly declaring his homosexuality. In 1979, after winning a much-publicized case, his discharge is upgraded to honorable. 9 years later, at age 44, he dies and is buried in Congressional Cemetery in Washington, D.C., with a tombstone that reads, "A gay Vietnam veteran. They gave me a medal for killing two men and discharged me for loving one." This week in Radical History for October 24th, 1871, rising anti-immigrant feelings and laws being passed, and a mob in Los Angeles on this date hangs 18 Chinese from the trees. Also on October 24th, 1901, in the Philippines, U.S. Marines land in Samar during the Philippine insurrection. U.S. Brigadier General Hell-Roaring Jake Smith issues his orders, quote, "I wish you to burn and kill. The more you burn and kill, the better I'll be pleased," unquote. Also on this date in 1968, Yavapai Tribe of Arizona wins $5 million settlement for 9 million acres taken from them 194 years earlier. Well, better late than never, I guess. Also on this date in 1990 in Italy, the government publicly confirms revelations exposing Operation Gladio, a grouping of Western anti-communist intelligence agencies funded by the American CIA. These agencies, working in concert and funding neo-fascists, often use a strategy of state terrorism, particularly during the late 1960s, but all the way up through the 1990s. These included carrying out sensational kidnapping, murdering, disinformation, and bombing designed to appear to be work of left-wing groups. So again, the CIA sponsored right-wing terrorism groups in hopes of destabilizing countries and keeping them from going to the left. This week in Radical History for October 25th, I only have a couple items. 1806, in Germany, philosopher Max Stirner lives, theorist of individualist anarchism, opposed to Karl Marx. He once wrote, "The great are great only because we are on our knees. Let us rise." Also on this date in 1862, another anarchist thinker, Ernest Corduroy, commits suicide. This quote of his fits well in today's realities as well. "In the shadow of the cruel and ridiculous spectacle arises the old war of the poor against the rich, which today, masked and falsified by ideological refraction, is the war of the poor who wants to stay poor and the poor who wants to stop being poor." Lastly, on this date in 1960, Martin Luther King Jr., jailed in Decatur, Georgia, held over on old traffic ticket charges, denied bail, and sentenced to 4 months of hard labor. This has been This Week in Radical History, produced out of the Gleegly Studios. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and radical info came from the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. As the elections draw near, here's a little short philosophy from George Carlin.
"Give these people a voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, 'Joy, I voted.'"
Amen, brother. So until next week's This Week in Radical History, I am forever yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon. I'll leave you now with some Ghost Mice.
What have we done? What have we done? Are we making any changes or just having fun? What have we done? What have we done? Is this more than just music? Is it more than just a club? Are we making any difference? Oh, what have we done? What have we done? What have we done? Well, just take a look around, and I'm sure that you'll agree that we've done a lot of things to improve community, like organizing protests and serving food, not bombs, sending books to all the prisoners that have been locked up for so long, throwing bricks through all the windows of the evil corporate shops, supporting mom and pop and standing up to the murdering racist cops. Seems like we're always talking about things we do wrong, but let's not forget to talk about the good things that we've done. Well, no, we've got our faults, and I must say that I agree, but punk rock music saved my life. I can sing it honestly. Sometimes it may seem like we haven't done anything, but I think that we made it a little bit better than it was. That's why I sing, and I'll ask you to sing with me.
the punks. Stop 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 the punks.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. The main purpose of this program is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. This week we take on the bias of the American media on the presentation of news and analysis concerning the Israel-Palestine issue. We feature the voice of Palestinian journalist, author, and screenwriter Rual Jibril. She was born in Haifa, educated in Italy, where she began her journalistic career, being the first female foreign anchor on Italian television. She eventually was driven off Italian TV for becoming a persistent critic of President Silvio Berlusconi. She then went to Egypt, where she also was driven out of the country for her on-air criticism of the Egyptian government. Here in the United States, she had hoped to experience a more free and open environment for journalists, but as you will hear, has faced enormous problems for critiquing our media for its biased coverage of the Israel-Palestine conflict. You may remember the incident during the Israeli assault on Gaza in the summer of 2014, when NBC reporter Amin Moyadin reported the bombing death of the four little boys running on the Mediterranean beach. He was initially taken off the air by NBC for his contextual reporting of the event, but later restored to his position when NBC was assaulted in social media for silencing a reporter for doing his job. It was an outrageous act of censorship. Rual Jibril, an MSNBC contributor at the time, went after NBC on the air. Shortly thereafter, Amy Goodman interviewed Rual on Democracy Now!, where she continued her criticism of the mainstream, not only NBC, but all of the media for its inept, biased reporting on the Middle East. We begin our program with this interview of Rual on Democracy Now!
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermin Sheikh.
We turn now to the controversies around media coverage of the crisis here in the U.S. Over the weekend, NBC reversed its decision to remove veteran correspondent Ayman Mohyeldin from Gaza. Mohyeldin was removed shortly after he reported on witnessing Israel's killing of four boys on a Gaza beach. His reports gave voice to Palestinian victims and placed the siege in the wider context of Israeli occupation, drawing criticism from supporters of Israel's offensive. NBC's decision to remove one of its top reporters sparked a massive backlash on social media, with the hashtag #LetAyman Report becoming a trending topic on Twitter. Days later, NBC backed down and Ayman Mohyeldin resumed his reporting on Sunday. In a Twitter post, Mohyeldin acknowledged the social media campaign that demanded his return, saying, quote, "Thanks for all the support. Proud of NBC's continued commitment to cover the Palestinian side of the story."
On Monday, one of MSNBC's frequent contributors, Rula Jibril, took to the network's airwaves to criticize the initial decision to remove Ayman and the broader exclusion of Palestinian voices. Jibril was speaking on MSNBC's Ronan Farrow Daily.
We're ridiculous. We are disgustingly biased when it comes to this issue. Look at how many airtime Netanyahu and his folks have on air on a daily basis. Andrea Mitchell and others. I never seen one Palestinian being interviewed on these same issues.
Well, I'll push back on that a little. We've had Palestinian
voices. Maybe for 30 seconds, and then you have 25 minutes for Bibi Netanyahu and half an hour for Naftali Bennett and many others. Listen, the Ayman Mohyeddin story. Let's talk about this. We are home, and we can discuss this. Ayman Mohyeddin is covering the Palestinian sides, and we get upset. It's too pro-Palestinian. We don't like it. We push him back, and thanks for social media that brought him in. Let's talk about these
point
issues.
Point taken, but doesn't it reveal equally our thinking that we now have Ayman Mohyeddin on air, and I think there's been very fair
yes,
and balanced
thanks to social media, and thanks for the pushback from the public opinion. And I'm not saying that everybody's like this, but it's one-tenth is giving to the Palestinian voice and 99% to the Israeli voice, and that's why the public opinion is pro-Israeli, which is the opposite in the rest of the world.
Shortly after the interview, Jabril tweeted, quote, "My forthcoming TV appearances have been cancelled. Is there a link between my expose and the cancellation?" On Tuesday night, she appeared on MSNBC's Chris Hayes.
We're joined now by Rula Jabril to talk about what happened. Rula Jabril is an author and political analyst who frequently appears on MSNBC. She worked for many years as a broadcast journalist in Italy, where she also covered the Middle East. She's the author of Miral, which was made into a film by Julian Schnabel. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Thank you for having me. It's good to have you with us.
Can you talk about what happened and the decision you made to speak out on your own network?
Well, I decided to speak on my own network because we are liberal Democrats, and part of the debate of any media in the liberal democratic landscape is to discuss our own flaws as well as others, not only Bridgegate, but also Mediagate, I would say, and media scandal regarding the bias covering of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And I looked at studies, and the studies that were made by many scholars, respected American scholars, Juan Call and others, who are referring to the covering of the media, how much airtime is giving to the Israeli officials and how much airtime is giving to the Palestinian official. And it's a U.S. landscape that is so biased. So, for example, in 2012, you had on CNN alone 45 Israeli officials interviewed versus 11 Palestinians. And when it comes to this conflict today, in 2014, you have 17 Israeli politicians, official interviewed, versus one Palestinian. So we are going backwards regarding this issue. And that forms and shapes the public opinion in America that then transfer and become political support unconditional to Israel, to a policy that is very destructive both to the Israelis and to American stance in the world and their credibility.
Were you the only Palestinian consultant or contributor on MSNBC?
Absolutely, yes.
So what happened after your appearance on Ronan Farrow, where you said what you said, criticizing their coverage?
I received emails of cancellation, and I asked a question about whether these cancellations are related to what I said earlier. I never had any. Tried to call the producers, and nobody answered the phone. Then I tweeted what I tweeted, and immediately there was a social media uproar. I understood. Listen, I worked in Egypt. I was kicked out of the country because I interviewed Amr Suleiman, the head of Secret Service. I asked him about torturing. I interviewed Silvio Berlusconi in Italy. I'm accustomed with this. When I pushed Silvio Berlusconi on corruption and scandals, my TV show was shut down. I'm accustomed to this. I did not, with all honesty, expect this from us liberal media and us who are advocating going out saying we tell the truth and we cover this in an unbiased way. I did not expect that.
The alternate writer, Max Blumenthal, spoke to an anonymous NBC producer who he said described, quote, a top-down intimidation campaign aimed at presenting an Israeli-centric view of the attack on the Gaza Strip, unquote. In his piece for Alternate, Blumenthal wrote, quote, the NBC producer told me that MSNBC President Phil Griffin and NBC executives are micromanaging coverage of the crisis, closely monitoring contributors' social media accounts and engaging in a, quote, witch hunt against anyone who strays from the official line, Blumenthal wrote. The producer told Blumenthal, quote, loyalties are now being openly questioned. Did you have any experience of that, Rula? How long were you a contributor at MSNBC? I've been there for two years,
and I have to say I was talking about the American landscape, not only MSNBC, which has been actually a little bit better than others, but I never experienced anything like this. I mean, I understood doing what I did in Egypt would lead me to be kicked out of the country. I understood in Italy, where Berlusconi controlled most of the media. I was shocked because most of my friends in the Middle East would tell me, you know, you will have an issue in America. And I always thought, no way. We're truth tellers. We're fact checkers. We're people that actually cover both sides. This is what America stands for. And I hope that MSNBC and other networks will actually revise their policies and will have more voices. It doesn't have to be me. It's not about me. We have a media scandal that we need to expose. We are responsible of these failing policies in Gaza and in Israel.
And you tried to raise this before in the 2 years that you were a contributor.
Privately, I raised it with so many, 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 many people in the inside. I've been pitching myself to talk about these issues on many shows. And I've been privately meeting with producers and others, and I told them, I said, listen, you have an issue there. Our credibility here at stake. We can't talk about Bridgegate for 6 months, and then when it comes to this, we decide, we duck our heads, and we decide to be exactly like the other networks. We can be different. We can be much more bolder, and we can be aggressive. And maybe the rates are this way because of this. I think most of them were agreeing privately with me, but then when it comes to what goes on air, I don't think they didn't have any power.
Now, you did go on Chris Hayes last night.
Absolutely. Chris Hayes contacted me late in the afternoon.
And he's on MSNBC.
And he's on MSNBC. Of course, we disagreed, but, you know, in the media, we can't agree to disagree. We have Joe Scarborough criticizing over and over, and he's fine, and he's okay. But one thing is to criticize certain things, but is this a hot issue that nobody can touch? Is this what America is becoming about?
So did you lose your job as a contributor?
I have no idea. I still don't know. My contract is up, and we're negotiating still.
And following your appearance on the show, you said one of the things that you hoped your comments would precipitate would be a national debate on the question of Israel-Palestine and how it's covered. What kind of shape do you think that debate would take? And if it were up to you, what kinds of issues should be raised more frequently in the mainstream media on this particular issue?
I think what we need to ask, are we really guaranteeing by supporting unconditionally this Israeli government, right-wing government, are we really helping Israel being more secure in the long term and ultimately American interest and stand in the world? Is that what's happening? And look, this policy with Gaza has been failing for the last 8 years. We had 6 bombardments in the last 8 years, and this did not topple Hamas and did not limit, weaken Hamas. Actually, it empowered more and more Hamas and moderates like myself. And for me, Hamas is the ultimate liability for the Palestinian people. But this did not empower moderates. Moderates has been telling Israel over and over, we want a peace deal. We will agree on most conditions that you want. And as Gideon Levy said, in this venue, in this same venue, the problem with our policy that we want to keep the status quo, that means military occupation in the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza under siege. And we want, and what we are doing in the media, we're portraying actually a false image where what's happening in Israel, and if you ask anybody, whether in New York, in D.C., in other places, what do you think is happening? They will tell you, oh, well, Israel was minding its own business. The Palestinians start shooting missiles out of the blue. This is not the reality. This is not what's going on. And the context of this is what's leading the public opinion to support unconditionally Israel. And politicians will do what's popular, not what's right. We need to do what's right. We in the media have a mission, whether it's MSNBC, Democracy Now!, CNN. We have a mission. We're truth tellers, and we can shape public opinion to protect public interests.
Rula, you have a fascinating story yourself, which you wrote about in your book, Miral, which was made into a film. Can you talk about where you were born and your own life story?
Look, I was born in Haifa. I am an Arab Israeli. I'm a holder of an Israeli citizen. I have my family lived all of their lives in East Jerusalem. I was raised in an orphanage. My family is both Muslims and Christians. I am married to a Jewish man, and I really believe in two-state solutions. A year ago, I discovered that I have a Jewish sister because my mother, that died when I was 5 years old, actually had a relationship, and I discovered a year ago that I have a Jewish sister that is tweeting today, in these days, killing Arabs is a value. This is the reality that I live in. And I have to be truthful because of what I've seen in the Middle East and because of what I witness, whether it's in refugee camps, under military occupation, under siege. I've seen how pain, grief, and when you keep 60% of the population that go almost hungry to bed and 90% without clean water, the only thing that can rise is extremism. And the solution to this is not to bombard them all together in one place. The solution to this is actually lifting the siege, empowering them financially, and let them themselves, create a moderate leadership that eventually can take over. We didn't manage to topple Hamas, and this is facts. We are failing in our strategy in how to contain extremists. Hamas was dead politically. We will manage with this war, actually, to revive Hamas and its power and its grip on the Palestinian cause.
How did you end up going from Haifa, growing up in an orphanage, to becoming a broadcaster in Italy?
Simply, when I was 17 and a half, I won a scholarship from the Italian government. I went to Italy. I studied there. I attended college. I became the first anchorwoman in the Italian television, first foreign anchorwoman, black anchorwoman in the Italian television. I was attacked by the right, especially during the Iraqi war, because I challenged their views on the Iraqi war. When I visited Iraq, it was clear to me that there is no way that a military solution will be met with cheering, and it was clear to me that the country would be divided immediately and the Shiites will take over. So I wrote about this. I was challenged by the right-wing government in Italy on these views. I was even called the N-word on air by one of the ministers of Silvio Berlusconi, who actually was pushed to resign 3 days after because of the uproar of the media. Because of that, then I worked for so many years in Italy. I was a reporter. I read the news. And then I decided to go to my own world. I went to Egypt. I worked there for 3 months. I was on-air journalist. I broadcast a TV show until I started asking the wrong question, a tough question to the establishment. After that, I was off-air, kicked out of the country. And I hope to find a platform somewhere.
And you just talked about your work in Italy. How would you say the reporting in Europe on Israel-Palestine compares to what you've seen since you've come to the U.S.?
Day and night. And simply because of the images that reporters bring from the ground and are allowed to show on air. Here, you know, we have a problem with what we show. The tipping point for me is when people like Rihanna and Selena Gomez are not even celebrities allowed to sympathize with the people that are dying, not with Hamas. When they wrote their Twitter and saying, you know, we pray for peace in Gaza and we sympathize with the victims, and everybody backlashed on them. And when even John Kerry was scared when his microphone was open on Fox, and then he had to actually walk back that line. That shows you something. Everybody's scared when it comes to these issues. It's time that we in the media have the courage to expose so many wrongdoing from our own government here and their wrongdoing abroad. It's time to it's time really to do a service, not a disservice, to our audience and to our interest in the world. And also to the Israeli, many Israeli people that, and Jewish people, as you showed in your network, that are today calling on Israel to stop their policies.
Rula, we want to thank you for being with us. Rula Jibril, author, political analyst, frequently appears on MSNBC. She worked for many years as a broadcast journalist in Italy, where she also covered the Middle East, is the author of Miral, which was also made into a film.
That was Palestinian journalist and author Rual Jibril being interviewed by Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! During the siege of Gaza in the summer of 2014. We're going to follow up that interview with a presentation that Rual gave at the Conference on Israel's Influence held in Washington, D.C. in the spring of 2016. This was a rather incredible conference that we will revisit in future broadcasts of This Week in Palestine, because it spent much time and did great analysis on the way that our media is covering the Palestine-Israel issue. Rual was one of the keynote speakers, and this was her presentation.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Delinda and everybody at the Washington Report. They've been very active lately, not only organizing this amazing conference, but I have to say, I received a phone call from Delinda 2 weeks ago, and I was visiting some friends in Florida who had some health issues. And Delinda said, well, I need to send you something urgently, and I think you would be fascinated by it. I didn't understand why she was secretive. Then Monday when I came back home and I opened, and there was this package of emails of some producer in Voice of America asking a former speaker of AIPAC if he would be fine that I would be the guest to debate whoever they deem as a proper Israeli official, eventually to debate him on television about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And obviously, I will, you know, spare you some of these misogynist, sexist, disgusting details of the back and forth. But basically, this has been the way my career, somehow whenever I was hired by anybody in American media, and I love when they, you know, when they are about to prepare a war, whether it's a war in Afghanistan or in Iraq, and it's like, we are going to liberate women. We will teach these natives how to treat women. And then you read these emails, and it's like, sure. I'm sure you know exactly how to treat women and how to talk about them. It's fascinating to have, you know, the superior culture. But it's a glimpse of the kind of power that they not only established, they exercise and wield shamefully, without any shame. But I am sure these emails were not the only emails. These are the emails that we know of. These are emails that we, you know, had access to. But I am sure if you read private emails, internal emails of any news outlet, whether it's the New York Times, CNN, MSNBC, you will find similar things where we're begging. Gideon said that the government is begging the Israeli government, and like, you know, we want to give you the money, and they're saying basically, no, we want more, and somehow we need to kiss their hands. But the media has played a major role in making this happen. You know, I grew up actually admiring American media. I grew up thinking American media is, you know, this is a media that managed to expose major cases of corruption in the history and force a president to resign. This is the media that inspired me as a child, because I thought, you know, you can live actually in a country where a simple journalist, a simple reporter can do his job or her job and can force the most powerful man in the land to answer some tough questions and eventually get, be forced to resign or be impeached. I thought that's the kind of dynamic of a vibrant democracy that makes this democracy vibrant. That's the kind of, journalism I didn't see around me. You know, I grew up in watching Arabic televisions where I knew that somehow somebody in the government has written the questions and maybe the answers also. So I grew up with that kind of culture, thinking, you know, something needs to change here. And I always looked up to Western media. So when I worked in Italian television, they hired me simply because I was the only woman that spoke Arabic. They needed somebody to understand the Middle East. They needed somebody that is native from the region to explain to them what went wrong, that famous article in Newsweek, what went wrong with the Arab-Muslim world. And I remember going to my director and explaining to him the difference between Shia and Sunni and why the Iraq war will be disastrous, because just simply looking at the numbers, the composition of the population in Iraq, 60% Shia. They sent me to cover the Iraq war. I started my career in Italian television, and I always love to be underestimated because it gives me more, you know, somehow more freedom, because as soon as I realized what they have, as soon as they realized what I was standing for, what I was doing, then these sexist, misogynist emails was some of the weapons they used and they throw against me. Obviously, it makes me laugh, but it makes me think that there's a lot to be done. American media has been the most disappointing thing I ever seen in my life. Even working in countries like Egypt, I've seen pushbacks by certain journalists, reporters,
TV hosts by far much more than in this country. And I'm saying that because I've seen how, what did that produce? Iraq was a war's choice. It was a non-sequitur country that was invaded for a non-existential threat. And it could have happened only with a tacit, silent, and vocal consent of American media, who sold a lie. And none of these people have ever been fired. They've actually been recycled, and they're still called as experienced and experts on many issues, on the Iran and the Iran nuclear deal, or and they're writing long essays about Obama's doctrine, as they call it. Nobody ever questioned their failures, their lies, their manipulation. None of that has happened, but they actually question the fact that, you know, my hair is long or short, or I am skinny or fat. I mean, we're reduced to a level that allowed and enabled every lobbyist to get away with murder and basically paved the way for Donald Trump to become the front runner. I think we're responsible of that. And it reminds me very much of the media in Egypt and Italy before the revolution. So when, you know, the title of the conference, Is This Good for America? Not only it's bad, you know, Israel influence here goes beyond Israel and Israeli borders. If you think of the larger dynamic in the Middle East, if you think how much money, you know, we're talking about $4 billion to Israel, think of the $2 billion to Egypt. These $2 billion are paid to the Egyptian regime that basically created a deep police state, a deep state, and doomed democracy in that country. This is the country that gave us Zawahiri, number one of Al-Qaeda today. This is the country that gave us political Islam. Inside the prison cells, the most atrocity has been committed. Torture since the 60s that produced, that basically radicalized an entire generation. And they left with one idea, transnational jihad. Go after the regime, create terrorist groups to go after the regime, blow up themselves. And guess what? Every one of their backers, starting with the United States. So somehow we enabled a government that produced mass radicalization. And on why? Because of one issue. Because of the Camp David Accords. Basically, we still give money to a regime that is committing atrocities and violating human rights and killing thousands of people and imprisoning 60,000 as we speak today. Because of that peace accord with Israel, or to keep the peace with Israel, or to do Israel dirty jobs. For example, you know, closing the borders with Gaza. The other ally that is, we never not only question it, but if you think of what Israel has been trying to push the United States to do, it goes beyond the Israel-Palestinian issue. We had Bibi Netanyahu, who came here to testify in 2002, and his words was, we need to go into Iraq because it will have, and you know, do the regime change that we need to do, because this will have a positive effect on the entire region. I mean, you look at the region, I don't see any area where this positive effect you can see. But the whole issue was one, and they've been vocal about it. And the one issue is, now they are so they don't even care about the Palestinian issue, basically. What they care about is the Iran issue. And the Iran issue has been the focus of this government for the last 20 years. So you have the prime minister, the minister of defense, Sylvain Shalom, and even the former ambassador, Oren, who basically are telling us that they rather have Sunni radical groups like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra Front, than any Shia group. As if the answer to the region is, yes, let's wage war on the Shiites and the Sunni, who gave us every, not only radical group, every group that have committed atrocities are actually, you know, we can turn a blind eye on these guys. This is the same reasoning. This is the same mindset of the Cold War. This is exactly the same mindset and never changed. As if they are not realizing that the post-colonial order that's been established in the Middle East have collapsed already, doesn't exist anymore. And it collapsed because of their choices. The Iraqi war basically ended that post-colonial era. But they are still thinking as if they are living in 1979. The mentality of the Mujahideen was that mentality. There is a Russian invasion, so the Russians are the enemies, and this is the Cold War mentality. So we need to create an alliance with whoever is there to defeat that monster. So we created a Frankenstein monster that is turning on all of us. And we keep repeating the same strategies and the same mistakes. And I understand that it's hard for a politician to change because they are beholden to the checkbooks of Sheldon Adelson and Haim Saban. Somehow, you know, sadly they call it legal corruption in my world. Here they call it Citizen United. But the real failure has been my colleagues, the people who are sitting on television with a revolving door. They served as a person for AIPAC the 10 years earlier, and then they are on CNN as a neutral TV host or some prison guard who served is lecturing people on some, you know, website on how they need to be or to behave as journalists. You know, somehow the system allowed for these voices to thrive and to become the establishment voices. And, you know, when you listen to people debating, oh, how did we not understand that Trump, you know, would become a front runner? The signs were all there. The writing were on the walls. What were you thinking when for years, since 9/11, the idea of us and them became, from marginal idea, became a mainstream idea. The them, you know, was your neighbor who was Muslim or Sikh or eventually, you know, Hasidic Jew or diversity. You know, the war on diversity started by eliminating critical voices in mainstream media in the United States. I mean, I can't even fathom till now how is possible that in a country that led serious investigative journalism and led to push an administration to resign with Nixon can be the country that allowed not only an administration to abuse their power and pass secret memos and spy on their citizens or torture some people. Are surprised today, you know, and some of these speakers are intelligent, surprised that you have fascists on the rise and basically telling you that you didn't actually do enough. You know, when I listen to these debates and I have some of my colleagues who don't even have a follow-up question on some of these candidates who are not only calling to commit war crimes, but they are saying it's not even enough. You need to, you know, expand those war crimes because, you know, waterboarding is not enough. You need maybe to kill him in order and kill his family and his relatives because this is what will make us all safe. Look, I never been in my entire life, I never worked so hard to make people understand what are the stakes. But I'm concerned for the next generation because, you know, when I grew up, obviously I watched that kind of journalist of Dan Rather and others. I think our children are growing up, if they are in their 15, 16, or 14, and they look for people to inspire them. I mean, if that person is Anderson Cooper, I want to jump from a window. The follow-up question is matter more than the question itself. To push back and to, you know, if your job is actually to expose lies, corruption, and deflections, and push them to answer it, and the only person has been doing this somehow, and surprisingly, and I'm horrified to say that, has been people on Fox News. I mean, we're looking at Megyn Kelly as the person who managed to actually challenge some of these candidates. So, but, you know, we looked for years at the first African-American president being smacked by the leader of a country of 7 million people. And here you have a country of 300 million people, supposedly the leader of the free world. And with Congress basically accepting that
and allowing that, that can lead only in one direction. This is the beginning of dismantling of a democracy of this country. And this is what is worrisome. The Israeli model is not contained in Israel. It's being transported and it's becoming part of the American model. So when you have police brutality and the police, and you know, the relation, the cozy relationship in the media, it's becoming a cozy relationship in the police departments. So the police, you know, who abuse their powers in Ferguson has been trained actually by Israeli police. And it's considered normal. Nobody's investigating these kind of cozy relationship. I am proud actually to be sitting with Philip Wise here, who reported about some of these executives at CNN who are speechwriters for Bibi Netanyahu. I mean, there's the level of cooperation and propaganda has reached such a level that today it's normal. We are the abnormal. We are the aberration. These people are writing the chapter of this nation history. I can't believe that I'm mentioning, this is a quote from Gramsci, my favorite European intellectual, who wrote from his prison cells. And he was asked about Mussolini. And he said Mussolini was not an aberration. Mussolini was an autobiography of a nation. He was part of this nation. He was enabled by the media. He was himself a journalist. He was enabled by a system that turned a blind eye. I think we need to push harder, and we need to fight more. And I think we need to create a community that is, we are part of an ecosystem that can help each other to expose this more. We cannot allow ourselves to, I mean, I can't, obviously 15 years ago I used to throw my shoe at the television. I can't do this anymore. I'm very happy to be ejected from certain TV networks, but I'm very happy actually to be part of a system that whatever Philip or Max Blumenthal and other people write, we need to cooperate so we can push that message. And it can't be a parallel world. It must be a united world, because the wave that is coming is by far much more dangerous. I've seen it in other places. I've seen it in Europe, and I've seen it in the Middle East. And these people are beyond ruthless. Berlusconi, when he was elected in 1994, the first three things that he did, he sued 18 journalists, kicked 18 others from television, from networks, people who dared to criticize him. Some of them were my friends, Marco Travaglio or Santoro and others. I worked for an Egyptian television in 2009. After 6 months, I had to leave because the level of bullying and abuse was beyond me. I couldn't control it. It wasn't about me. It was about the people who worked with me. And I knew that while the establishment was talking about the transfer of power from the father, Mubarak, to his son, the people were talking about actually three things. And these three things still exist. They were talking about freedom, democracy, and dignity. And this is what I kept hearing from the ground. So the detachment between the base and the establishment, and the gap is so deep, but we need to stay tuned with the base, because actually the base will lead the change. I don't believe the establishment will anymore, but I believe the base, the millions of people who were neglected around the Arab world, stood up one morning, apparently without any reason. 3 months earlier, Hillary Clinton said it's a stable country, and people ignored those voices to such extent that they didn't even bother to think or to ask them what you want, what you think. These people stood in the streets and demanded dignity. They overthrow a regime, they had setbacks, but that kind of power, that kind of sentiment is still out there. It's not dead. It's dormant, but it's not dead. I am sure it will rise again. I am sure, like I'm looking at you. And I hope in that moment we'll be ready to help them and build a bigger bridge, a bridge that will unite us here and in the Middle East. And it will not be about them and us, but it will be about all of us. Thank you.
That was Palestinian journalist Rual Jibril speaking at a conference on the influence of Israel that took place in Washington, D.C. We finish our feature on the media with a presentation made at the same conference by veteran journalist Philip Wise, co-founder of Mondo Weiss. Here he takes on the New York Times.
Thank you very much. Thanks to Linda. You know, I just have to say that Rula's invocation of the Vietnam War and what journalists did around the Vietnam War was very important to me, too, as a young journalist. And I remember that I was at the Philadelphia Daily News 35 years ago, and the guy at the next desk had read Harrison Salisbury's book about the Pentagon Papers. And that was when the New York Times took on the government. You know, the government tried to shut down the New York Times publication of this vital document that explained the history of the Vietnam War. And the Times stood up to the government, and, you know, it helped to bring, took a while, but it was very important in bringing an end to the American participation in that disaster. And my friend at the next desk said, let's write to Harrison Salisbury. You know, we're never going to get a story like that. And so we wrote this letter, and we said, Dear Mr. Salisbury, you know, how do you plan your career? We were just young, ambitious journalists. How do you plan your career so that you can, you know, get ready to take on the government and, you know, have a big story like that? And what I remember about his letter is that he said, you know, just hang in there, learn to be good journalists, you know, work hard, and someday you will get your big story. And the thing I find really moving about that now is that, in fact, we did get that big story. We got it in the shape of the Iraq War, and just what American foreign policy has been in the last 10 years. And the New York Times has been AWOL on that one. And I think I may have said this last time, that gives tremendous power to our community. If you think about how much information that people in this community are developing in the way that journalists are supposed to develop, traditionally, have developed information that's vital. Even this fact that both Rula and Colonel Wilkerson said earlier about the extent to which the aid package to Egypt is essentially a bribe to keep them to hold them. This is a central fact of our foreign policy that just you won't find stated, and that is on a par with anything that was in the Pentagon Papers in terms of a vital understanding. So I'm here to talk about the New York Times chiefly because the Times sort of sets the parameters and the tone for the mainstream discussion. And I did once do some work at the time, worked staffer at the Times Magazine. And I thought I would just anatomize the Times a little and then move on to the whys of it. Why is the Times sort of in the tank for Israel? So the newspaper has been a reliable Israel supporter for a long time now, and we keep looking for signs of a thaw. And I think, you know, I'm going to be hopeful, but let me first describe the character of that support. And I will be describing, as I go through my remarks, I'll be using the term Zionism. And I think that Zionism is embedded. It's a very important force at the New York Times. And what I mean by that is some degree of commitment to the idea of the need for a Jewish state and the need to preserve a Jewish state in Israel. So the Times has at least three columnists who are openly Zionist. And those are David Brooks, who has said that he gets gooey-eyed about Israel when he thinks about Israel and has been there a dozen times. It was a couple of years ago. I think he's been there more since. Roger Cohen, who says that Israel is justified by the Holocaust, but he can also be somewhat critical of the occupation. He is openly a Zionist, which I think is a very good thing in as much as he's frank about his adherence to the ideology. And then there's Paul Krugman, who is a liberal Zionist, who says he's critical of Israel, but never expresses it, says as little as possible. You would think that winning a Nobel Prize and having a Times column would give you freedom, But Krugman surely demonstrates Tolstoy's principle that the higher you get, the less freedom you have. And I'm leaving that other stratospheric columnist, Tom Friedman, out of this list, because while Friedman began his career as an Israel supporter back in the suburbs of Minneapolis doing chalk talks on the Six-Day War at his high school, I think that one of the principles of this conference is that people can change. And I sense that Friedman has fallen away from the ideology in as much as he has said, for instance, that Congress is bought and paid for by the Israel lobby, which is a statement that if a non-Jew made it, would brand them as an anti-Semite. I think the standard is not being nice enough about Israel. And he has also said recently that the two-state solution is a failure, and that that failure was produced by, among others, Netanyahu and Sheldon Adelson and the right-wing Jewish influence, openly speaking of right-wing Jewish influence. And that was a very important column, and I'll return to it because I think it's the heart of what I always understood journalism to be. Not quite the heart, because I always understood journalism to be what's new, true, and important. And it's true and it's important. It's just not new, what Friedman was telling us. So I think you may know that David Brooks' son served in the Israeli military, and he's one of four Times reporters who have had children who serve in the Israeli military. The most celebrated example of this was Ethan Bronner, who was the previous Jerusalem bureau chief. His son entered while he was writing for the Times, and it was shortly after Cast Lead, when Israel slaughtered 1,400 Palestinians in Gaza. And it caused Palestinian activists, in a truly masterful act of branding, to paint the New York Times logo on the apartheid wall. I don't know if you saw images of this, but it was just kind of wonderful. Bronner introduced a guessing game into journalism about unspoken ideological agendas. This was, is he or is he not a Zionist? And I think that I participated in this guessing game. A lot of journalists in the blogosphere did. And when he left the newspaper, ultimately, in the last year or so, He left less and less doubt about this question, and resolved it entirely, when he hosted right-wing Israeli military figures at the 92nd Street Y in New York on a program that was about the quote-unquote incredible courage of Israeli soldiers. So When we started the same guessing game when Ethan Bronner's successor, Jody Rudoran, took over after him in Jerusalem, and I remember that I sort of was a little bit more credulous than others. I'm not proud of this, and I sort of thought, oh, she's going to be fair, and then But what we found was that she wrote totally out of the Israeli Jewish experience. That was really the community that she openly admitted that she related to more, but she made little effort to get outside that comfort zone.
That was Philip Weiss of Mondo Weiss speaking at a conference on Israel's influence in Washington, D.C. last April. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
The lower class family unit must be disintegrated by a process of increasing preoccupation of the parents and the establishment of government-operated daycare centers for the occupationally orphaned children.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Between 15 and 20,000 people homeless or in overcrowded housing here in Bristol, all the politicians say it's a priority. But will Marvin Rees actually do anything?
He was suspended without pay last week from the University of Lethbridge in Alberta, Canada, after somebody shared a Jewish hate post on his Facebook page. Professor Anthony Hall is one of the world's experts on Native American history and author of Earth into Property. He's Skyping, calling into us right this very second, but we can't bring him up on the desk. There's no sound, I'm afraid. We'll try and get him on the phone. Yes, he's the author of Earth into Property on the privatisation of America by the colonists in the Indian Wars, but he's also an outspoken critic of the official narrative of 9/11. He teaches students the war on terror is nothing but an excuse to undermine international law so the US can invade any country it feels like. Also, rents on a ratchet, with the housing benefit increasingly going to keep buy-to-let landlords in clover. The great housing debate. Shelter reported in April 8 million people, one payday away from eviction order. Crisis say a homelessness duty in England that exists in Wales would cost £44 million a year nationally here, but it would save £46 million in all the costs associated with helping the street homeless. Every mayor promises to sort it out. So how is Marvin Rees getting on 5 months into his term of office? If he hasn't got things moving by now, will he ever? Paul Smith, you heard in the first hour, will be back along with housing campaigner from Avonmouth, Steve Norman, and Matthew Strange from the tenants' right group Acorn. Yes, been having problems. We can't actually hear Tony Hall, apparently, even though he's Skyped in. He's been very kind enough to do that from Alberta in Canada, Martin. But this is a case, one of those typical cases, in fact, of academic freedom. He's been targeted because somebody else, believe it or not, put a hate post up on his Facebook page.
Well, it's not even clear who would have put such a hate post up on his Facebook page. Somebody that was targeting him could put the hate post up on his page and then claim that he's done nothing about it and therefore he has to be punished by the authorities of his university. Probably he is being targeted because of his controversial views, and it's fairly clear that it's the pro-Israel Zionist lobby, B'nai B'rith in this case, who are unhappy with what he's saying and are trying to get him taken off the, basically lose him his job, even though he's got tenure at the university there. And this has happened to quite a few academics who've questioned 9/11 and also been controversial from a Zionist point of view in criticising the State of Israel. The State of Israel is and its supporters are incredibly litigious and rather tricky. So in any case, as you say, it's not his post on the Facebook page which has led to him being suspended from his job. Are we responsible for what other people put up on our Facebook pages? No doubt there's going to be an appeal and a discussion about this. Well,
he's not the first person to be subjected to this sort of thing at all, is he? And there are questions, of course, over whether it's even he's responsible. I mean, he's fighting this, obviously, in Canada. I was speaking to him last night. And he's saying that there are some accusations that his principal of his university has broken the law here.
Well, he may have a strong case to make to the appeal tribunal, but I think that some people are just not prepared to tolerate people with views that they don't like, and are prepared to ruin the careers of those whose political views they oppose, and that's very dangerous because universities, in theory, are supposed to be places where controversial views, any views, can be expressed as long as they're expressed in a responsible fashion, and you shouldn't try and silence people just because you disagree with them. And I don't think it's accidental that Anthony Hall's been picked out because he is, in fact, a cutting-edge critic of the war on terror, and some people don't like that.
Well, I've I've asked him to give us a call in, just so that we could do it on the phone rather than on Skype, because for a reason it's not coming through here on the desk. Oh, we can see him. He can hear us and everything, but we can't hear him, so there's no point in putting him through. You can't hear what he's saying at all. So let's have a listen now to some of Anthony's previous comments from a talk he did a few years ago. The talk was entitled, "Is War Really a Remedy for Terror?"
As I'm coming to see it, the exposure of the lies and crimes of 9/11 cut so deeply, they so discredit such a sweep of the ruling class, that there is something profoundly subversive and revolutionary in our movement. And I think we need to talk about after, you know, I think we've actually done it. I think the hard work has actually happened. When I go to conferences with learned professors and whatnot, when I'm with people who are opportunists, careerists, want cracks on mainstream media, want government contracts, you're not going to get that by exploring these issues of what really happened on 9/11. So we, you know, it's not a good career move to go into this area. And I was glad to see the university politics, the academic politics that Professor Stephen Jones has faced on his campus and that I face on my campus when, for instance, Jonathan Kay attacks my graduate student when he gets a small scholarship, $7,000, Joshua Blakeney, to study 9/11 skepticism, the origins of the 9/11 wars. And we're attacked in Canada by the most powerful press machinery in the country. But my administration is holding with me. And so we can do this in the curriculum, and we're developing this in the curriculum. I'm not emeritus. I'm teaching on Wednesday night. So I'm taking responsibility for this. What are the other questions? Anybody think there's another basic question that comes up when you say, well, I'm pursuing 9/11 truth?
Why?
Like you run into, well, look, there's famine, poverty, financial debacles, war, every kind of rape and pillage all over the planet. Why would you take this one issue when there's so many other important issues? Well, I think those of us who've come to the conclusion that we put our emphasis here understand, look, we're lied to all the time. We know that. As children, we had to figure it out very early in life. You're just lied to on the media all the time. So what's the big deal? So there's some lies involved here. I think there's a understanding among us that this particular category of lies, this complex of lies, is so audacious. It's so diabolical. It's so comprehensive. And it's not rocket science to look at Building 7 and say that's a controlled demolition. We can argue about was it nanothermite, was it this or that. But the larger picture, you know, NORAD, what is the history of Al-Qaeda? What happened at the Pentagon? Why was Bush in the bunker was Cheney in the bunker and Bush in Florida? On and on and on. There's not one element of the official story that really stands up. So we have come to the conclusion that we're not going to let this category of lies go past us. And I think we can give ourselves a hand. And we will stand together, and we will protect each other, and we will watch each other's backs, because there is a certain danger right now, and that is such a horrible commentary on the violation of the principles of the UN Charter, that what happened here in 1945, the principles of common decency, the principles of the rule of law.
Well, I mean, it's a shame that we haven't got him live, but of course that was an audio recording of his position. And you can see that he's taking a strong and determined position about 9/11 and also other issues, the war on terror. And I'm afraid one of the reasons why senior academics don't speak out is because they know it's more than their job's worth to tell the truth. but some people have got the guts to tell the truth anyway, and he's one of them.
Well, if you remember, back a few years ago, we had a tour from Guy Fawkes 9/11, and we booked it in. This is Webster Tarpley talking about 9/11, yeah. His analysis of those attacks at Bristol University. A few days before the talk was due to happen, they said, oh, we're not allowing this lunatic to use our lecture theatre, so we had to then find somewhere. Actually, it was QEH across the road. We're fine about it. But, you know, this sort of thing is about trying to control any kind of real discussion and debate within the highest echelons here at Bristol University, as well as over in Lethbridge, of interpreting September the 11th attacks. These are elite institutions, and they seem to be controlled by the same people who are behind the war on terror.
Well, if do a thought experiment, if 9/11 was an inside job, you can imagine that the people who carried it out are quite sure, quite determined that people are not going to ask questions about it. So anybody who does ask questions about it is punished. And therefore, those who might be inclined to speak out then realise that you know their jobs are at risk, their mortgages are at risk, and it's you know, you don't even need to tell people in many academic institutions what not to talk about if you want to keep your job. And occasionally, of course, somebody has to be thrown to the lions to make sure that the message is taken on board. And then, of course, they say, well, nobody's criticising us. Then there's no academic criticism. It's not there's no academic criticism, because those who do criticise are thrown overboard.
So Anthony Hall is also an expert in Native American studies, and he makes the point of the whole war on terror is like an extension of the Native American Indian Wars. Do you think that's stretching a point, Martin?
Well, I mean, there's a continuity there, is there not? Underlying all of this is greedy, powerful oligarchies who are determined to control the world's resources in their own interests.
Well, he's also talking about the names of tribes and specific individuals in those Indian wars, Indian tribes, that have been co-opted by the current US military.
These helicopters might be called Black Hawk or Apache. And of course, the most famous Apache was Geronimo. And when Geronimo was the code name given to Bin Laden, or the impersonator of Bin Laden, or the faux Bin Laden, you know, that was very significant. Prescott Bush took Geronimo's, he robbed the grave in 1918 and literally took the skull to the Skull and Bones Club. So that's that naming of Bin Laden, Geronimo, that's what I start the paper that I wrote for this presentation with. So this text here, the cover, the reality that Indigenous peoples in North America who fought the expansion of the American Empire and the transcontinental expansion of the United States of America is an imperial land grab, and it was genocidal. And ironically, those who opposed and fought it, like, for instance, Black Hawk, who was an Indian man in the Illinois area. You know, he has a weapon named after him, a helicopter named after him, the Apache helicopter. Of course, Geronimo was in the custody of the United States of America for much of his life, for decades. And the United States could never say, is he a domestic prisoner who broke the laws of the United States, or is he an international prisoner? Is he a prisoner of war? And so the issues that come up in Guantanamo are very old in the history of this country. And the expansionary impulse of the American Empire is very deeply rooted in the Indian Wars.
That's Professor Tony Hall, who's been suspended without pay up in Alberta, Lethbridge University. And I hope he's joining us on the phone now. Hi, Tony, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, fantastic.
I hear you perfectly. Do you hear me?
Yes, we do. Anyway, if you could just briefly tell us what's the latest with the whole your suspension. Are you going to get your job back or what?
You know, I'm still a professor. I'm a suspended tenured professor, which seems to be an internal contradiction. And I think this reflects very significantly on the jurisdiction where my school is, University of Lethbridge is, because there is a new legislation brought in that apparently gives university presidents the capacity to simply suspend a faculty member based on whatever whim that president might have.
Well, they're there, but you can understand that. They're supposed to be running the university. They're in charge. Why shouldn't they suspend you?
Well, of course, there is at universities this institution called tenure. There is a need to protect those researchers who study things and come up with conclusions from their research, which may not be well received by power. For instance, you know, Galileo at one point started saying, well, Copernicus is right. Actually, the sun, you know, is the center, not the earth. And, you know, he had to eventually, he was under house arrest for the rest of his life. So this institution of tenure is, you know, it's an international institution. When you go through this process, specialists in your specific field are assembled. They may be in Botswana or, you know, South Africa or Lithuania or Japan or wherever. So it's a very international aspect of the academy, which is to say that at the highest level of the academy, it's not just a little local thing under the thumb of some politician or some schmoozer. You know, there is a 500 people have signed a petition saying that the chairman of the board of governors at the University of Lethbridge, Kurt E. Schlachter, should resign because he did not protect academic freedom.
But Tony, what's happened here is that you have actually done things like linked the September the 11th attacks to the Israelis. I mean, how can you possibly do that?
Well, you know, I can read. I can read Christopher Bolin. I can see the different publications and the different postings of Alan Sabrowski. You know, my colleague on False Flag Weekly News, Dr. Kevin Barrett, takes a similar position. And, of course, you know, what happened on 9/11 is contested. But to my way of thinking, the strongest interpretation is that the Israel First neocons, the project for the new American century, the Netanyahu government, which is Likudnik, which is very, you know, going back to, you know, bombing of the King David Hotel and is very much centered on scientific use of terrorism, that there's no question that the most compelling interpretation of who did 9/11 is Israel First neocons to demonize Muslims, to produce a new enemy. After the demise of the Soviet Union, there is the military-industrial complex, core of the political economy of the United States, without an enemy. Israeli First neocons essentially supply the enemy. They create this false flag event on 9/11. Isn't it interesting that the first announcement of what's happening comes from Ehud Barak, the former prime minister, Labor prime minister of Israel, who just happens to be in the BBC studios and just happens to announce before even the Twin Towers fall in that interval after they're hit by whatever they're hit by, and you know, they're going to collapse. But before that, there he is saying, we need a war on terror. Osama bin Laden is the most obvious suspect. He basically lays out the whole scenario for what we now call the global war on terror. And we have that same interpretation given by, you know, the Blair government, the Cameron government, the Harper government, the Trudeau government, people, you know, people of great scholarly merit, like Professor David Ray Griffin, like Peter Dale Scott. I would count myself among that group. I publish on this in a peer-reviewed text, a big book called Earth into Property. I spoke on that text when I came to London in 2011, and I believe you were playing tapes from my time in London. So I'm, you know, I'm a scholar. I'm 65 years old. I've, you know, published. I have a very strong publishing record. And whether Mike Mann, the president of the University of Lethbridge, who is a phys ed teacher, who's kinesiology, I mean, he's just arrived in town recently, whether he thinks it's kind of weird that I say Israel had a role in 9/11, well, my scholarly credentials are beneath that assertion. And, you know, a lot of research is beneath that assertion. And, you know, we don't know in every detail how it was done, who did it, but we know the neocons, Israel First faction, like Michael Chertoff, who was in charge of the investigation on behalf of the Justice Department. He was in the crucial chair. He transformed the investigation into the crime of 9/11 into a cover-up. You know, very early on, the steel, which is an evidence of what it is that made those buildings come down in the very peculiar way that they came down, where they sort of burst into talcum powder and vapor. And, you know, where did the energy come from? Was it, you know, melting steel and gravity? That just is not credible. And so the evidence of the steel being carted away under Chertoff's control And, you know, he is a Israeli U.S. dual citizen. Dov Zakheim, Richard Perle, you know, Netanyahu himself, who in 1979 organizes the Jerusalem Conference on Terrorism and sort of invents this scenario of international terrorism and starts to say this is, you know, this is the scenario that the West has to direct and control to win terrorism, how the West can win, the book that comes out of this Jerusalem Conference of 1979.
But surely, I mean, you're actually one of the only people around the world who's a professor that's saying this stuff. I mean, surely you, all the other 99% of professors can't be wrong, Tony.
Well, I mean, the other 99% of professors just kind of avoid the subject. When you really get down to who will actually defend the official story, one of them is Michael Shermer. He came and spoke at our university. And, of course, this technique of saying, well, conspiracy theorists, it's kind of a mental illness. He's showing pictures of brains. He's saying, you know, they think this and that about Mars, or this about that about Elvis, or this or that about the Holocaust, or this about 9/11, connecting all these issues. And, you know, it's really a disgrace. And so Michael Shermer, I stood up and said, you know, you are a disgrace to the academy. He actually came from Claremont University, where David Ray Griffin, who's written 10 serious books, Professor Griffin, you know, a very senior, esteemed, genuine academic. This Michael Shermer is speaking at my university like a TV professor. He's on Oprah. He's on all these TV shows. And he's invited to my university. It's really humiliating to see that. And so I said, this is not a professor, a genuine professor. I wrote to his dean. He advertised himself as adjunct professor of economics. The dean wrote back and said, I don't even know who this person is.
Well, look, Anthony, people can still follow you, can't they? Because you do some sort of internet newspaper and also the False Flag Weekly News. Whereabouts is that?
Well, False Flag Weekly News is produced by No Lies Radio. We just did this week's version of it. So for the last 2 weeks, one of the big subjects is to report from the trenches, as it were, about what's going on at the University of Lethbridge. This story is becoming international in scale. There's obviously a problem with our universities. We talk a lot about the corruption of the mainstream media and the Zionist bias in the mainstream media from, for instance, the Rupert Murdoch press. But universities are, you know, strangely kind of silent, and it's not a good career move, for instance, to address 9/11.
Well, as you've found. But what about your internet newspaper? What's that?
Well, it's called American Herald Tribune. I'm editor-in-chief of American Herald Tribune. And if you go there, you'll see the perspective that I've been developing and colleagues like Kevin Barrett and Rafiq, also known as Robert S. Lewis, have been developing. So we're creating a record of this ongoing saga of crushing the institution of tenure and trying to take universities more severely than they already are under control. In this case in Lethbridge, it's the Brené Brith, you know, part of the Anti-Defamation League of Brené Brith, a very old, rich, powerful organization. And basically this organization emanates from the government of Israel. And even in the mission statement of the Brené Brith candidate, said its mission, its purpose, is to advocate for the security of Israel.
But your president at your university, or principal or whatever, is worried that you're teaching young revolutionaries.
Well, you know, I would not talk this way in my class. I assume that you're calling me and you have some background in this and I know who you are. And, you know, I talk on Press TV about twice a week. And, you know, the Press TV out of the Islamic Republic of Iran, out of Tehran, it's an international network. But we know that the Islamic Republic of Iran is right in the sights of Israel. And, you know, Sheldon Adelson said it should be nuked and Hillary Clinton seems to agree. You know, there is a sort of imperative to identify what's really going on here, this building up of the imagery of Islamic terrorism. Of course, this is a big media scam. It's sometimes referred to as the Islamophobia industry. It needs to be identified. But really, this important stand that I'm able to do this at the University of Lethbridge, people have, you know, said, how can you do that? And I had an understanding with, for instance, Andy Haken, who is, you know, understands, you know, I've had a graduate student who's from London area, Joshua Blakeney, who's quite well known in some circles. Original breakthrough on 9/11 came as a result of Mohawk activists splitting the sky, sort of persuading me I have to work on this. When splitting the sky attempted a citizen's arrest of George W. Bush in 2009, you know, Kevin Barrett was very much present. I worked with Cynthia McKinney, the former congresswoman.
Okay, Tony, can you just give us your... We're going to have to finish there. Can we just give us your websites finally, please, so people can have a look at some of your work?
Check this out at the American Herald Tribune. I'm going by the name Professor Tony Hall. There's a backlog of stories. We do it every week on False Flag Weekly News. The trouble here for me in Lethbridge started last summer when a journalist by the name of J.W. Schnarr wrote an article on the front page called Conspiracy Theory. If you want to see the smear on me, there's a website called Canary Mission.
I'm actually more interested in some of the things that you've said that have caused this the trouble. You know, that's, I think, much more interesting. But anyway, look, Anthony, we've got your False Flag Weekly News and your newspaper as well. Thanks very much for joining us. Finally, we managed to get around to you on the politics show here.
Anthony.
Thanks. Martin, this is all really about academic freedom, isn't it?
It is. And, of course, when people like Professor Hall, who are actually, senior academics, are booted out of their roles like this, it sends a clear message to younger people who are studying in universities about what their career prospects will be if they try and ask questions about these matters. But ultimately, of course, this kind of intimidation is not to be tolerated. We need to speak freely about things, honestly about things, and some people may not like what they hear, but that's just too bad, isn't it?
BCFM. Now, German terror suspect Jabir al-Bakr's jail death is a scandal. This is a terrorist suspect apparently killed himself in jail this week, Martin.
Yeah, isn't it interesting that people that carry out these terrorist attacks supposedly end up dead so that they can't tell any tales about who recruited them or whether they were guilty?
What amazes me more than anything else is that nobody in the mainstream press at all has suspected, well, maybe these German police are crooked and they've killed him.
Well, that's more, nobody asks these questions about all sorts of things. The issues are that, as you well know, it's not just 9/11. Many of these so-called terror events have very, very suspicious backgrounds.
Well, we've also had the Deep Cut Barracks, the second of the re-inquests, with this guy who's supposed to have committed suicide by shooting himself in the chest 5 times.
As you do. And, of course, what tends to happen, of course, is that certain people can be need to be eliminated because they know too much.
Okay,
and that's
finally,
the kind of thing that happens.
Finally, on our international section here, 40 million people in a massive drill in Russia. The Russians are gearing up for potential nuclear war. 40 million people involved in this drill last week. The Germans and the Swiss are saying stuff your basements full of canned food and that sort of thing. What's happening here in Britain?
We're living in a bubble where none of this is happening, although we've been told this week that we're going to get very, very upset about Syria, but we don't dare do anything about it. And, of course, we're not really confronting the fact that it's quite like the British intelligence services who helped to start the war in Syria.
There's very little talk, is there, about the offer of the Russians and the Syrians to allow all of the al-Nusra out of East Aleppo with their guns, but then they refuse to go.
Well, that's why we've not heard about it, because why wouldn't they want to go if they wanted to save... What they're doing is they're holding the civilians there as hostages and human shields, and that's exactly what the Israelis accused Hamas of doing in Gaza a few years ago, if you remember. And I don't think, in actual fact, that the Syrian and Russian air forces are doing anything like as devastating an attack on East Aleppo as the Israelis carried out on Gaza.
One of the people behind all this, of course, is the US Army Chief of Staff, who is... Mike Miles, I believe, and he had this to say, and maybe you'd just like to comment on him before we have the clip.
Well, he's not the only one. Lots of senior US military personnel are bloviating and trying to create as much tension as possible. And that's because Obama's a lame duck president and the Pentagon are now running the policy without any supervision from the White House.
I want to be clear to those who try to oppose the United States. I want to be clear to those who wish to do us harm. I want to be clear to those around the world who want to destroy our way of life and that of our allies and friends. The United States military despite all our challenges, despite our op tempo, despite everything we've been doing, will stop you and we will beat you harder than you've ever been beaten before. Make no mistake about that. Other countries, Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea, went to school on us. They closely watched how we fought in 91 and 03. They studied our doctrine, our tactics, our equipment, our organization, our training, and our leadership. And in turn, they revised their own doctrines, and they are rapidly modernizing the military today to avoid our strengths in hopes of defeating us at some point in the future. Recently, a senior Russian official, Ambassador to the United Kingdom, Alexander Karamenko, he said, quote, "The established world order is undergoing a foundational shakeup with the Crimea, Ukraine, and Brexit." He went on to call for the dismantling of NATO and the European Union. And he said, quote, "Russia can now fight a conventional war in Europe and win. Russia is the only country that will remain relevant forever. Any other country is dispensable, and that includes the United States. We are endgame now," end quote. We can now, and we will remain in the future, retain the capability to rapidly deploy, and we will destroy any enemy, anywhere, anytime. Additionally, the battlefield will be highly complex, almost certainly in dense urban areas and against an elusive, ambiguous enemy that combines terrorism and guerrilla warfare alongside conventional capabilities mixed with large civilian populations.
So that's the U.S. Army Chief of Staff there with a pretty horrific warning for us all. Yeah, we can obliterate anybody whenever we feel like it. Sounds like almost like he's trying to take us back to the days of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Anyway.
Dude, go for it.
So we're joined now by Steve Norman, by Matthew Strange from Acorn, and also by Paul Smith again. Thanks for hanging on for us, Paul. And I'd just like you to set out your stall to begin with on what you're going to be doing to build houses in this city, which the previous mayor didn't do.
Well, what we're doing is using our land to produce new housing and to lever in and to ensure that we get affordable housing. The private sector isn't delivering on affordable housing. In fact, most of the private sector is finding every excuse not to build affordable housing. So it's about getting our land out there, but not by selling it, by holding on to it until housing is built, rather than passing it over. I passed the Speedwell swimming pool site, which I think was sold 8 or 9 years ago by the council for flats, and I think I've said on this programme before, selling land to build houses on, all that allows people to do is to speculate in the land market rather than forcing them to build houses.
Well, you do wonder if some of these people aren't really just land speculators rather than developers. Anyway, Steve Norman from Avonmouth, what do you think needs to be done here?
I think that Paul and his and America have got the right ideal. I think the problem they got is, one, within the structure of the council, the officers are resistant to change. Two, I think that there needs to be more community involvement.
Well, when you say that, what do you mean exactly? People getting out, building things, getting bricks and building houses themselves?
Well,
what do you mean?
I'm not necessarily building, but I think there are enough trades within the community that can open up houses that are, you know, that are currently not in use because the system is slow. In reopening.
Paul, can I ask you, how many houses have you got that are empty and properties, buildings that are derelict or disused?
Far too many. At the moment, there are almost 500 empty council properties. Now, you would expect a landlord the size of Bristol, there should be about 250, maybe 300 tops. But there are far too many of those empty. There's also empty schoolhouses, empty parks houses. And, you know, one of our priorities this year is to get those opened up, because opening up existing buildings has the same effect as building new ones. But, of course, it means that you're not using up land. But I have also released land for 1,800 units so far.
Well, yeah, but you've been in for 5 months.
I know. I haven't finished them all off yet.
Well, I mean, how have you got started?
Hmm?
Have you actually got started?
Yes.
In what way? Could you give us some examples?
Well, we've put three sites out to housing associations, one in Lawrence Weston, one in Coombe Dingle, one in Knowle. We've got one site in South Bristol where we're going to be building new council housing. We've got, obviously got the Hengrove Park, which has attracted a lot of attention. We've passed Astrey Close in Lawrence Weston over to Ambition Lawrence Weston. We're working with the South Mead Development Trust on, firstly, on making sure Dunmail happens, the school site there, but also looking at their proposals built up with the community for Glencoyne Square. So we've got lots of sites at the moment which we're putting out there and getting ready to build. Obviously, they've got to go through the planning process.
But hang on a minute, that shouldn't be too difficult. You're going to give them planning permission, aren't you?
I can't give them planning permission. I'm a developer.
Well, the council can.
They still have to go through. I mean, they still have to go through the same planning process that anybody else does.
Okay, Matthew Strange, tell us a bit about Acorn. What exactly is it? Because I think you represent, to quite a large extent, one of the, I suppose, people who are at the sharp end of this, that is private renting tenants quite a lot, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, well, Acorn began 2 years ago in Easton with 100 volunteers and essentially started building a tenants' union to defend the rights of tenants. You know, there's some unscrupulous practices going on by landlords, by letting agents, you know, really high fees. Properties being left in a state of disrepair. And so
one of the games I've come across is this whole business of, well, you complain to your landlord that you've got rising damp or you've got a broken window or that your boiler isn't working, and they say, oh, all right, fair enough, we're going to evict you now.
Yeah, absolutely. And some landlords, say some, will use any excuse to get another tenant in that will pay that £50 more, that £100 more. Very recently, actually, there was a revenge eviction locally that was stopped by a group of Acorn members. And
so what
members
is it, a revenge eviction?
So a revenge eviction is whereby the landlord, holding a grudge or having an issue with his tenant, attempts to remove them from the property by any means necessary, essentially because they don't like them, irrelevant of their, you know, security, the fact that they have family, children, any of these
things. Now, I remember seeing pictures in the Bristol Post, actually, of people sort of lined all the way down the street trying to protect this person. What happened with that instance?
Well, the bailiffs came and the bailiffs left. There was enough of us there. True solidarity. It worked. It was effective. The media coverage was good. It got into even the Daily Mail. There was a bit of misreporting from the landlord. But other than that, I think it was quite effective.
So, I mean, as an organisation, what are you actually able to achieve for people who just feel that they're paying far too much for what they're getting as a private tenant?
Well, it's pretty difficult. It's a really complex situation. Not all landlords are greedy. In fact, most of them probably aren't. There's other things that are happening, interest rates, mortgage rates, a propensity or an urge to use property and land instead of pensions. So there's massive land banking going on. And this is, you know, a question to Paul, I'd say, as well. It doesn't matter how many affordable homes we build. How do we stop speculators buying them to then let them to the highest bidder? That is an issue of the market. Yeah. That is not anything that can be solved locally by Bristol City Council. I do commend the efforts of the new establishment to get things going and getting houses built, but I think there are some deeper issues that are related to the market.
Do you want to just take take one on?
Yeah,
on.
Well, what we're doing is keeping ownership of the land, because a lot of the speculation comes through the land ownership, and also working with community-based organisations like South Mead Development Trust, like Ambition Lawrence Weston, like the Redcliffe Forum, like the Knowle West Media Centre, then other organisations that are coming forward, that the properties are owned collectively rather than individually. Now, obviously, we can't do that with housing that's built for sale, but with the affordable housing that we're building, we can maintain the ownership of the land after the housing is built.
You satisfied with that, Matthew?
Not entirely. I mean,
it doesn't solve the whole problem.
No. And what is the definition of affordable? I mean, if we just take minimum wage, we had a bit of council tax on top, we had a bit of other duty and a few other things, and really,
we just put the two letters U and N in front of it, and you've got it.
Yeah.
Because it isn't affordable at all.
No, it's unaffordable.
Yeah. Well, obviously, there are some people who use the word affordable in the non-technical term, and it's unfortunately it's not a common sense word, but In terms of affordable, in terms of what we're looking at, it's affordable rent, which is either social rent through the council, the housing association, or some sort of community trust. And so those rents do tend to be affordable. The average council rent is £82 a week. Housing association is probably about £20 or £30 higher. And the definition is supposed to mean housing affordable to people on low incomes and benefits. And the test is, can they afford to move from full housing benefit into work without being in a financial crisis?
Well, one of the things that Steve was pointing out earlier, Paul, was that we've got a lot of people on very low incomes, or some of them either unemployed or whatever, that have got the skills to actually do places up and build them. I mean, you've got all these empty properties. Why aren't you doing something to bring people in who got the time and got the skills to do them up?
Well, we've been doing that through Bristol Together, which works mainly with ex-offenders to do up the properties that we've brought so far out of our empty property group, which previously were being auctioned off. We've been working with Bristol Together. They've been bringing in ex-offenders. They've been training them or skilling them up to take those properties on.
So have you got to go and commit an offence and get called a criminal before you can get on that scheme?
Well, you have. No. But I think there is an opportunity to have other schemes maybe targeted at young people, maybe people in colleges, to do more of that work and expand. Because obviously there's a limit to how much that organisation can do. But, you know, why would we do that with ex-offenders? Because all the evidence is, and I think the evidence from that organisation is that if you take people who've been offending and you give them skills and you give them work, and they are paid, they're not doing the work as volunteers, then they stop offending and they know they are no longer sort of a danger to other people. So I think that's a good thing to do. It's not the only thing that we can do. We're also working with organisations around self-build within Bristol as well. And yes, if we can galvanise more of the skills of the people of Bristol, the council not trying to do stuff but facilitate stuff, then that's all to the good.
I know one of your beefs, Steve, is that there's quite a lot of money is spent on things like hostels, maybe possibly even too much, and that a lot of the accommodation that people are being put in when they present themselves as homeless to the council is just not up to scratch.
Well, yeah. I mean, what was allowed to happen in Bristol was one particular company were able to get control of the hostel system, and this is not fit. They're flea pits. They're not fit for inhabitation.
Is that true, Paul? There's only one company that's running hostels?
Is Steve talking about the homelessness organisations, of which there are many in Bristol, which run hostels, or is he talking about the private sector ones, Colony and Callaghan?
Obviously, I didn't want to name them, but Colony and Callaghan is a classic example. Mm. I mean, you know, let me give you an example.
Basically, just to be clear, of the people who are in temporary accommodation, about 80% of them are in homes owned by Colony and Callaghan.
And that is an horrendous situation, as we've seen from the hostel in North Street, and the sewage in the basement, and the way the building was connected, it was like horrendous. You've got children in there, you've got families in there. This is where Mr. Palmer was, as you know. We took photographs of the sewage, and the response back from the officer who was in charge was, well, it's okay, it's behind a locked door. Well, just ludicrous. It's raw sewage. You know, people get typhus from stuff and crap like that.
Well, Paul, it seems pretty obvious that, potentially anyway, that something needs to be done about, first of all, not putting all your eggs in one basket, but also about checking what kind of standard accommodation. After all, us council taxpayers are paying for this.
Absolutely, and paying through the nose, it has to be said. And we're working on alternatives to using the private sector to provide housing, temporary housing. As I say, we've been refurbishing our properties and bringing them back into use. We've identified quite a few more that we can do. We're also looking, at the moment, the council is using a spot contract system where it's paying a huge amount of money per night to place people. If we can turn that into a block contract, we could probably get people to build specialist accommodation that we can use, or to buy good quality accommodation, knowing that there's a sort of long-term security around the finance. So that's absolutely something that we've got to do about. What the council is doing at the moment is not acceptable, and I'm not defending it. It's just not good enough.
How long until you change it, then?
Well, we're working on it now. We've already started changing it. More and more people are actually in council-owned accommodation rather than in private sector accommodation. But we've still got, the last figure I got, which was for a couple of nights ago, 285 families in private sector accommodation, of which about 230 were in C&C accommodation.
I think as well, we probably need to address the situation. When I first arrived in Bristol, you could get some digs, room with a sink, 150, 200 quid. Something like a hostel, but something to call your own, not supported accommodation. More houses under multiple occupation. Mm. There has to be some look at how we address that. Student accommodation is also exploitative, charging through the nose, both Bristol University, UWE, and even the private sector also charging students horrendously. Mm. We need something in the middle between hostel and having your own flat or home that just allows people to get their head down and just get on with finding a job or whatever it is they're trying to do in life.
Yeah, I completely agree.
So how are you going to do it?
Well, we're looking at procuring different types of housing now. Unfortunately, you know, anything we do that's new, as I say, has to be procured and go through the planning system. But we are starting. And the thing is although it may take some time to sort some of these things out, if you never start, you never finish either. So
I suppose that's why we're having this discussion, you know, just a few months after you've taken office. Because, you know, you've got, what is it, 4 years left to go?
Three and a half years. Yeah, I'm running out of time. I'm very impatient. I mean, I think the other point that Steve made is really important is that we've inherited a local authority with a whole load of cultural issues about how hierarchical it is, how it doesn't empower its people enough, the way in which it sort of closes ranks whenever it does something wrong. And we're also working very hard to change that culture. We're doing that as, you know, sort of part-timers, effectively, coming in from the outside. But it is something that we're doing.
A couple of weeks ago, I came along to your big housing conversation. What's the point of that?
Well, it's about engaging other people in the debate rather than the usual suspects. And, you know, next Wednesday morning, I'll be at a meeting talking to property developers. And another day, I'll be talking to housing associations. And, you know, it was certainly, you know, very much, you know, driven by Marvin that we should actually be doing more to speak to the consumers and the people who are being failed by the system rather than just the people who are making money out of it.
Now, what about St Mungo's? What role do they play?
St Mungo's provide a service to street homeless people, so they will go make contact with them and try and give them the appropriate advice and support.
Well, I mean, anecdotally, talking to some street homeless people, they say, well, St Mungo's come around, have a chat to us. They're then reporting back that certain people might be asylum seekers or might not have citizenship of Britain, and then they get raided by the immigration authorities. So is St Mungo's supposed to be doing that? Are you aware?
I'm not aware of, I mean, it's been said to me tonight that some of them, I'm not aware if there's any use of St Mungo's to police the homeless in that way.
I don't think they're necessarily policing, they're just informing on who's out there. So it
which
seems
is effectively
me,
policing.
This is a sort of intelligence gathering operation, it seems, as well as there to help the homeless. So why are we funding this?
We're funding them to support the homeless people, make sure that they've got proper advice and proper support.
What about the issue of tents? Because this is another thing we've come across. There's a kind of cross, as it crosses over from the Ferguson administration to the Marvin administration. I'm interested to see, I mean, are you going to be confiscating people's tents, evicting people who are in a tent because they've got nowhere to live?
Well, I mean, my view is that we shouldn't take from people their property. And if their property
theft.
Yeah. So if their property is a tent, then we shouldn't be taking it from them. Obviously, the best place to live in Bristol is not in a tent. So what we should be doing is finding alternatives that are acceptable to those people, which are more permanent and within doors. So it's, you know, it's quite a tricky situation. Our parks are not supposed to be places where people are living.
But they will be if you fail to house people.
Yeah, and that's the problem we've got, isn't it? Is that we are, in some respects, failing to house people. There are also some people who actually, as a council, we haven't got a duty to house, but we've still got a duty to support them. And we've got to find what can we do within the resources that are available to the authority. Earlier on, we were talking about the people who desperately need home care that we're not providing service to. We can only put up a hand up and say, yes, we're not, because we haven't got the resources. And what we've got you know, increasingly government gives us more and more responsibility and less money and expects us to square the circle, and it's not possible.
What about this crisis report? We reported on this show earlier this year about it. It was saying that in Wales there exists a duty to house people, including street homeless people. I think is it something like 40 days or something? You've got to get them somewhere permanent to live. And the estimate is that that would cost £44 million. This is nationally to implement this scheme. And they're also saying, crisis, they've got an expert panel working on this over last winter, that it would cost, it would actually save £46 million because it would, all that money which is spent on helping the street homeless. So why aren't we already doing that, Paul?
Well, actually, it is the approach we're trying to take in Bristol. I mean, it's often seen that, you know, we do these counts. There's 100 people, roughly, at any one time, sleeping rough in Bristol. They're not the same 100 people that were there a month ago, very often, because people are moving through the systems that we've got. They're coming into the night shelters. They're maybe going into the hostels. They're maybe going into the guardianship schemes that we're setting up in ex-office blocks. They may be getting into permanent housing. And then more people are coming through. And there is actually a private members bill going through Parliament at the moment to have that duty within England, which we are supporting.
Private members' bills never make it, though.
It's got, actually, as I understand it, this one's got government support.
Wow.
And we are supporting it too. And it was raised, one of the things raised in the big housing conversation about things that we should be doing. And as I mentioned earlier on your show, we're also working through the city office to make more accommodation available to allow people to come off of the streets, particularly in the winter.
Now, Matthew's just passed a little note to me here suggesting, why don't you designate an area for people who are in tents, just as you do with travellers?
Because ultimately, we don't want people to be in tents. We want people to be indoors. And again,
the fact of the matter is, Paul, they are. What do you mean you don't want them to be?
If you're in, I know. And what we're trying to do is help them move into the mainstream housing. And you know, if you take some of the sort of tent cities that we've had in Bristol, although there's maybe permanently been 8 or 9 people in them, they're not the same 8 or 9 people. People have been moved in, moved through that in the same way that they've moved through street homelessness. So what we don't want to do is suggest that we think the answer to the homelessness problem in Bristol is some sort of permanent tented city, because those tents, particularly as we come into winter, is not somewhere where people should live. What we've got to try and do is solve the housing problem.
Some of those people, for example, have been banned from hostels. They've got nowhere else to go but in a tent.
Well, I'm not sure that those people have been banned from all the hostels that there are. And again, that's a failure of the support services if they've been banned.
Okay, well, look, we're coming up near 2:07 now, so I just want to go have a final go-round with Steve. If you were sitting in Paul's shoes and Marvin's shoes, what would you like to see most?
I'd like to see more community involvement, more organisations out there. I'm not going to mince about it. I'm not a lover of St Mungo's. I've heard the same as what you've heard. I know of one case where someone with learning difficulties, it's been failed by St Mungo's that many times. I think that there are other ways that the money can be spent than just looking to one organisation.
Paul, how much does St Mungo's get paid to look after one person, do you know, roughly, per night?
I couldn't give you that figure off the top of my head, and I wouldn't want to make it up. I think their contract across the year is about £1 million.
Okay. Tony, I want to pick up on Connolly and Callaghan as well. You know, let's be fair, these people have got, what Paul said, 80% hold on the hostel situation. But there's something else that people don't know. Connolly and Callaghan applied for planning permission to build the new eco homes at Irmin Way in Avonmouth. Now, we're talking affordable housing. These houses are going at £250,000 a piece in Avonmouth. Show me a person in Avonmouth that's going to be able to get a mortgage.
Well,
it's
the old word affordable again, isn't it? Matthew, you know, if you were in
the top...
They're down for that site.
They haven't got planning permission. Matthew, if you were in the top job, what couple of changes would you like to see?
I would maybe go down the route of, say, like what we've tried to do with Bristol Energy. I would set up an actual bank or a mutual building society, some type of construction company that doesn't really look for surplus, that employs locally, but apprenticeships in colleges, universities, young architects, and actually looks at a variety of different solutions. And therefore, that housing would be not owned by the state. It wouldn't be owned by the private sector. It would actually be owned by all of us. And I think this kind of quasi in the middle area is kind of where we need to be.
Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we take an in-depth look at Censored 2017, the 40th anniversary edition, and the top censored stories and media analysis of 2015 and 16. The new book, Censored 2017, is out on Seven Stories Press, and today we will be in conversation with the co-editor and associate director of the project, Dr. Andy Lee Roth. We'll be joined by Nolan Higdon, the contributor to the Junk Food News chapter, and independent journalist Manar Mahawish of Mint Press News joins the program to talk about her stories and media democracy in action. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we look at the latest release from Project Censored. It is Censored 2017, 40th Anniversary Edition, the top censored stories and media analysis of 2015 and 2016. And our first guest will be Dr. Andy Lee Roth. He is the associate director of Project Censored. He coordinates Project Censored's validated independent news program, and he has co-edited six previous editions of Project Censored yearbooks, in addition to contributing chapters on news photographs that depicted human cost of war and also the Military Commissions Act. Andy Lee Roth joins us by phone today. Andy Lee Roth, tell us about one of the main themes here that runs through not just Project Censored's work, but especially this year's volume.
Thank you, Mickey. We've dedicated this year's volume to the late Ben Bagdikian, the pioneering critic of the corporate media consolidation, a champion of the public's right to know, and in fact, a Project Censored judge for nearly 25 years. And people who heard Bagdikian speak in public or are familiar with his written work would have often heard him riff on the theme of media power is political power, right? To have power in the media is to have and to wield political power. And this is, as you suggest, certainly a theme running through Censored 2017, the latest yearbook, but also I think it in some ways is crystallization of a lot of what we at Project Censored are doing and trying to accomplish. Just to give one example of that, maybe start with a negative example of what media power is political power might look like. Listeners may remember the statement that was attributed to a George W. Bush administration official in 2004 that when empire acts, it creates its own reality. and this unnamed Bush administration official, who's now widely believed to have been Karl Rove, spoke disparagingly of what he called, by contrast, the reality-based community. And Mark Danner, commenting on this, summed it up as, power has made reality its bitch. So that's one version of media power is political power. But I think we at Project Censored and the contributors to Censored 2017 are looking at what we might think of as a more affirmative version of the conception media power is political power. One way I think that that comes out is, what is the role of media, and particularly the news media, whether it be the corporate model of the news media or an independent alternative model, what is the role of that in shaping our expectations of democracy and what it means to participate in democracy? So that's a major theme in this year's book.
Indeed, Andy. And the dedication quote in the beginning, Begdikian says, to give citizens a choice in ideas and information is to give them a choice in politics. If a nation has narrowly controlled information, it will soon have narrowly controlled politics. And Begdikian wrote The Media Monopoly in the early 1980s, sounding the alarm bell when he said there are only 50 corporations controlling the media. Today, we're down to 6 controlling 90% of media in the United States. And indeed, we do have a narrowly controlled political structure.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, one of the things that he commented on when he produced the final version of his pioneering work, I believe it was 2004 that the new media monopoly came out, he quipped that the directors of the remaining corporate media entities that controlled the great majority of media in the United States, what most Americans have access to, would have fit in a small telephone booth, perhaps somewhat uncomfortably, but nonetheless in a telephone booth. And part of what he was talking about there is, I think, relates back to our 1987 number one story, which Begdikian contributed to, where he made the trenchant comment that democracy is no longer a daily experience in most Americans' lives. And I've been thinking about that observation a lot. It may seem like in the midst of a presidential election campaign, you know, this is all people are talking about, it seems, Trump and Clinton and who will prevail and who will vote for. But I think if we take really seriously what Begdikian was talking about when he says that democracy is no longer a daily experience in our lives, the thing I've been thinking about is, there's a difference between living in a democracy and participating in democracy. And if you think about living in a democracy, is in some ways it describes democracy then as an external condition or a habitat, right? It's like the environment we live in. And I suppose that version of it might work for what we're getting via the corporate media in terms of the current presidential election campaign. But to actually participate in democracy, and to participate not just in democracy on a, you know, 2- and 4-year cycle, but to participate it, as Begdikian called for, on a daily basis, is a distinction or a goal, I think, that's at the heart of what we at Project Censored have been trying to do across the 4 decades, 5 decades of the project's existence, especially in the efforts to engage students on a daily basis in actively and systematically scrutinizing the corporate news content, and in turn, to the students playing an active role through the book, through the website, in their communities, in informing the public about the results of that research on the corporate content of corporate news. So, you know, I don't want to say that Censored 2017 or even the work of Project Censored is a silver bullet cure-all for restoring robust democracy in the United States. But I think it does get to, and this is part of why I'm so honored to be involved in the project, it does get to something that Begdikian was writing about more than 25 years ago, about the need to make the experience of democracy a daily experience in most Americans' lives.
Hi, Andy. It's Peter Phillips. Certainly, Ben Begdikian would look at this and understand that the corporate media and their idea of democracy is which toothpaste to buy. And that's pretty much the only democracy we get when you go to the supermarket and you have several choices. But to have any kind of understanding that our democratic process, to be involved in it and have an impact on national and international policies is extremely limited, if not zero. And certainly he told me in the late 90s that he thought when he was at the Washington Post that probably two-thirds of all the stories at that time were coming from public relation firms or PR people inside of government. So most of the news was prepackaged and spun. We now know that that's much higher in the 80% or above range. And so this is corporate messages or spun messages in terms of certain interests in the world. And so that theme, I think, is very much part of the book this year.
I was just going to say, Andy, the story that you had alluded to from 1987, that's one of the things that Project Censored has done for years is what's called Censored Deja Vu, looking back at past years. And in the 40th anniversary edition, our national judges went and selected what they thought were some of the more significant of the number one stories over the years. And that happened to be one of them. And those are cataloged in Chapter 2 of the book, Censored Deja Vu, Strolling Down Memory Hole Lane, about stories that we forget about. And Big Dickian's, of course, was one of those stories. Coming up to the present in the 40th anniversary edition, Project Censored has been telling the news that doesn't make the news for 40 years, and this year we have another top 25 list of these kinds of stories. And could you talk about the first story, the number one story, in fact, this year? Could you talk to listeners about that?
Yeah, so our number one story is that U.S. military forces are deployed in 70% of the world's nations. This is a story that was brought forward by Nick Terse, initially in Tom Dispatch, and subsequently with additional coverage in The Intercept and The Nation. And the heart of the story, in some ways, just to keep what is a complex and involved story relatively simple for the sake of our time, is that according to Special Operations Command, in 2015, there were special operations forces deployed in 147 of the world's 195 recognized nations. So that's our 70% figure. I think the historical perspective, even a near historical perspective, is important here. As Terse reported, that represents a nearly 80% increase since 2010. And when you look at the financial cost of that deployment, you see that it's quite significant. In 2015, the Special Operations Command budget funding had reached nearly $10 billion. That's an annual budget. Now, if you think about how this gets covered or not covered in the case, again, this is our number one most significant but underreported story for the 2015-2016 news cycle. Corporate media have not covered the massive expansion of special operations forces around the globe, much less given it a kind of critical assessment as to whether those missions are resulting in meaningful accomplishments. And I think one reason that this is so is that this is, in effect, the background to the kind of stories that the corporate media do cover, right? It's the unspoken background for the more dramatic reports of specific single military operations or policy decisions. For instance, one of the things we documented when we looked to see, well, what, if any, corporate coverage has Nick Terse's findings received, Time magazine ran a story that had a map of the world that showed nine places where U.S. military personnel are currently stationed. None of those were located in Africa on the Time magazine map, even though, as Nick Terse's reporting has documented, some of the most significant deployments of SOCOM forces overseas since 2006 have been in the African continent. So we see, at best, a kind of veiled, marginalized coverage of this. It's the taken-for-granted background. Of course, U.S. forces are operating everywhere, and I think it's important that that be treated as a story in its own right rather than a background context.
Andy, story number two in the book this year reminds me of, you know, if you watch television, the pharmaceutical ads are quite prevalent for every kind of ailment. There's a pill. But the medical research seems to be in doubt. Could you tell us a little bit more about story number two in the book this year?
Yeah, story number two is the crisis in evidence-based medicine. And one of our sources on this is actually the editor of The Lancet, a very prominent medical journal. Richard Horton is the journal's editor. And in April of 2015, he wrote in the lead editorial of that issue of The Lancet, he wrote, "Something has gone fundamentally wrong with one of our greatest human creations." He continued, "Much of the scientific literature, perhaps half, may simply be untrue." Now, Horton is not the first editor of a major journal a major medical journal to raise these concerns. In 2009, Marcia Angel, who was the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, a former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, had made similar claims, saying it's no longer possible to believe much of the clinical research that's published or to rely on the judgment of trusted physicians or authoritative medical guidelines. And she pointed a clear finger at the way science is incentivized by the pharmaceutical industry's undue influence.
That's a very significant story.
In some ways, the most significant finding here, or the most significant reporting here, is coming from people like Charlie Cooper at The Independent in the UK and Sarah Bosley of The Guardian, also in the UK, who are reporting on the countervailing forces to this trend, right? Which include the launch of what is known as open data, an open data initiative that involves basically saying any pharmaceutical company that is conducting clinical trials on the efficacy of a drug in development needs to make the clinical trials publicly available to independent researchers for their evaluation. This component of the story is almost entirely unreported in U.S. corporate media. We have to turn to outlets like The Independent and The Guardian to get news on this new open data initiative. We found one instance in the Washington Post where the open data movement was mentioned in passing, but none of the specific initiatives were identified by name, much less discussed in any detail at all. So the corporate press have essentially ignored not only the crisis, but also one of the institutional mechanisms that might address the crisis.
Andy, one of the stories that my students found last year was about 1.5 million families in poverty in the U.S., very, very low level of poverty. Could you talk about that, story number six?
Yeah, that's the 1.5 million American families live on $2 per person per day or less. And this is reporting, always nice to have sociologists and their work represented in the top 25. This is reporting that's ultimately based on a study by two sociologists, Catherine Eden and Luke Schaefer, who published a book called $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. And Yes Magazine ran a feature with an interview with the authors. The author of the Yes Magazine article said the depictions of poverty in the book read like a Dickens novel, and that therefore, because the U.S. media, the U.S. corporate media, seldom cover poverty and the experience of poor people in any kind of detail, that the results of Eden and Schaefer's study would be startling to many people. Just one example, Eden and Schaefer talk with a mother who is making plasma donations twice a week to provide the income that her family needs in order to have food on the table. And making plasma donations, for anyone who's done that, is far more complicated than making a blood donation. So this research is also, Eden and Schaefer's work is also a policy critique of the long-term consequences of President Bill Clinton's 1996 welfare reform initiative, which essentially tied welfare to employment, which works fine if the employment sector is doing its job, but when there simply are not jobs available to people, the result of welfare reform is that many people are not covered by that protective safety net, and they're left to do things like selling their plasma to feed their children.
Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored, your co-editor with me of Censored 2017, 40th Anniversary Edition. There are several stories here that we won't have time to cover in this program today, but we will certainly be doing other features on these. Among some of these stories, we have another update on Fukushima unending. We have another story on how the FBI has new plans to spy on high school students around the country. Climate change impact and gender inequality is another story. The New York Police Department caught editing Wikipedia on police brutality cases. I mean, again, there are so many of these stories. And just quickly to wrap up this segment, Andy, could you just tell our listeners a little bit about the process of how we go about looking at these stories and how many we reviewed this year? And again, you know, we want to remind our listeners that the way we define censorship is more broadly than traditional definitions, because these stories are covered places. It's just that they're woefully underreported on, and as you illustrated, often covered by either independent press or in foreign press rather than here by the corporate media.
Yeah. I mean, the process is a year-long, five-stage process. the upshot of which every story has been thoroughly vetted by the time it's posted, by the time it's included in the top 25. But I would say, as much as the process, and people can go online and read in nitty-gritty detail about the different stages of review, the point I would want to conclude on for today is to talk about the significance. Each of these stories that we've talked a little bit about today, or that Mickey has just mentioned, are important in their own right and deserve attention as individual stories. But to me, the most important thing of producing an annual list of stories, this top 25 list that Project Censored has produced since its founding in 1976, right? So we're talking about now a cumulative body of some 1,000 underreported but significant stories. The significant thing about them is how this represents a kind of systemic critique of the corporate media's blind spots and an equally systemic affirmation of the crucial role played by independent journalists and independent news organizations in the United States, right? And if you step back from the details of any one particular story and look at the list of stories as a whole and the cumulative 40 years of story lists, what you see is, in effect, the raw data that is behind the systemic critique of the corporate news media and how it fails to serve our interests as citizens and community members.
Indeed. Andy Lee Roth, co-editor of Censored 2017, 40th Anniversary Edition, also the associate director at Project Censored and professor of sociology at Citrus College. Andy Lee Roth, thank you for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
Thanks so much, Mickey. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Andy.
You can find more information about the top censored stories of this past year at projectcensored.org. After this brief musical break, we'll be back with Professor Nolan Higdon, who contributed to this year's Junk Food News and News Abuse chapter. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're looking at the contents of Censored 2017, the 40th Anniversary Edition, out now on Seven Stories Press, edited by myself, by Andy Lee Roth, along with Project Censored. We have a foreword by Mark Crispin Miller and our cartoons by Khalil Bendib once again. And on the line with us right now, we have Professor Nolan Higdon, who has been contributing to Project Censored for a number of years. And the last few years, he's been the force behind Junk Food News and News Abuse. This year in the book on Chapter 3, The Corporate Media's War on Reality, Faux Elections and the Facade of Democracy. Nolan Higdon, you join us by phone.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Nolan, tell us about some of the junk food news this year and the theme that you chose on the election primaries.
You know, so interesting forces came together to create the chapter this year. One major one was the 40-year anniversary, and Jensen had been inspired by the hijacking of the presidential election of Nixon. And at the same time, we were in the midst of our own form of presidential election here in the United States. And so we decided to write the Junk Food and News Abuse chapter focusing on the 2016 presidential election. Most of our work in the book was dedicated to the primary election. And to be quite honest, the book kind of almost writes itself. It's so easy to spot junk food news in this supposed election cycle. But we mostly focused in the junk food portion of the chapter, which I'll remind listeners, junk food are these non-newsworthy stories that distract from newsworthy stories. We found that the rise of Donald Trump to be emblematic of junk food news, and that any comment he made, he was covered at length. In fact, he had three times the amount of coverage of Hillary Clinton, $2 billion in free coverage of Trump. And kind of one of the most revealing episodes we talk about in the chapter is Bernie Sanders had won on primary night, and he was going to give his speech, but the major networks didn't cut to Sanders' speech. Instead, they showed an empty podium because they were waiting for Trump to arrive. And that was just sort of emblematic of the junk food news cycle that Trump has dominated in the last year in the United States. And to be quite honest, is also responsible for the rise of Trump, that he actually leads one of these major parties and has remained somewhat of a contender for presidency of the United States.
Nolan Higdon, one of the parts of the chapter in Junk Food News this year on the Trump card talks about how Donald Trump was covered as a junk food news story years ago and was a, you know, reality television personality and so forth. And we see a lot of that bleed over into the presidential campaign and the infotainment side of media coverage in American politics. And one statement was quite striking that I wanted to share with listeners. Right in the book about CBS, the chairman of the board, the president, Les Moonves, who was at a conference in San Francisco at a broadcasting conference, and he admitted to the crowd there that the Trump coverage led to increased profits. And he said, quote, "I've never seen anything like this, and this is going to be a very good year for us. Sorry. It's a terrible thing to say, but bring it on, Donald. Keep going. It may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS." Even though 75% of Americans agreed that corporate media were covering Trump far too much, far too often.
Again, just such an egregious example. These news agencies are supposed to inform the American public about these elections. And generally speaking, you know, most journalists like to posit themselves as rising above the reality show fodder to do some critical coverage. But this whole news cycle was so dedicated to reality television that, you know, it's left a lot of us wondering, you know, was Trump actually running for president, or was he trying to use this as a publicity stunt to launch his various failed businesses? But, you know, to even sort of further underscore what you were pointing to there, even people who have worked in establishment reporting, like Andrew Sullivan and Keith Olbermann and Greta Van Susteren, even they came out just disgusted with what was going on in the news coverage of Trump. So even insiders were disgusted by what was going on in the corporate press. And we document that in the book as well. But as you also point to, there were a lot of profits in Trump. Trump drew a lot of attention. And you know, we've reported for years in Project Censored that these junk food stories or this attention launches candidacies. And Trump was an example of that. Trump benefited from this round-the-clock coverage. But I doubt the American public will say they benefited from this coverage. In fact, as you pointed out, 75% of Americans agree that there was too much coverage of Trump.
That's certainly one of the core issues in this chapter and that you lay out. Nolan, junk food news has always been a fun thing for students to engage in and write. They get very creative with it. Going back, I remember in the mid-2000s, the death of JonBenet Ramsey, the little girl, child beauty queen, occupied the news to a great extent. When that story came up, we had to think about that and go, well, it wouldn't be right to call this a junk news story because it's certainly an important story, but it was so covered almost daily for months. So we came up with this idea, well, this is a story that's been abused, news abuse. Now, we use that kind of catch-all to look at stories that are propaganda-based or news abuse. What did you find in this year's book?
The second part of the book, chapter Junk Food News Abuse This Year, is dedicated to the coronation of Hillary Clinton. The Clinton was coronated by the corporate press to be the nominee for the Democratic Party. And keep this in mind to your listeners and readers. We wrote this prior to these email leaks. And so it was interesting to see how everything we had confirmed by looking at news stories and paying attention to interviews and watching the news cycles was then confirmed when these emails were released. And in fact, the Democratic Party was working with the corporate press to coronate Clinton as the nominee for the Democratic Party. I think we can say that with some certainty. And so we found many examples of this news abuse throughout the previous year's cycle. In addition to calling her the front runner even when she was tied or behind the polls, other forms of news abuse, they tried to redefine progressivism, and we talk about this at length in the book, that Hillary Clinton starts to be defined as the progressive. I mean, they wipe away a lot of history in a lot of Clinton's history on things like crime bill and human rights abuses, her coziness with Wall Street.
In fact, Nolan, she was dubbed the progressive who gets things done.
When her Wall Street speeches were released in the last week, even there she admits she calls herself a centrist. So all of her past we can point to, she's not a progressive. We have her admitting she's not a progressive. But once Bernie Sanders on a somewhat progressive platform started improving in poll numbers, then all of a sudden Clinton was labeled, yeah, the progressive who can get things done. This is managed news that's done on purpose. No one can really look at the history of Hillary Clinton and call her a progressive unless you have some ulterior motive. And in this case, the ulterior motive was to get her the nomination for the Democratic Party as the presidential candidate.
Yeah, you can't really call that junk food news. Certainly Donald Trump's coverage was junk food, but you can't call that coverage of Hillary. But that was an abuse of truth and certainly a story that was managed top down.
Absolutely. And like I said, you know, readers will read this and then be amazed that we did this prior to these email leaks, that we were able to find this information just purely by watching the news cycle and doing what Project Censored has always done. And it was a really good confirmation of the work that Project Censored does that was then backed up by these emails. News abuse, for sure, but the corporate press working with political parties to manage our elections. That's why we again call it like faux democracy or facade of democracy.
All right, and the spelling of democracy has an M-O-C-K in it as mocking the process. The chapter always has kind of a pithy, tongue-in-cheek kind of approach for things. That's pithy with a T-H. The chapter concludes, Nolan, and I wanted to segue into this one more thing to talk about. As the book was going to publication, a Harvard study by Thomas Patterson was released. Harvard's Bradley Professor of Government and the Press, in conjunction with the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy, they drew many of the same conclusions as Project Censored regarding unequal and biased coverage during the 2016 primary season. And again, as you illustrated before, now that we've seen these WikiLeaks documents, it's even further support of the notion that the media has been completely biased and in fact continues to be so.
These are all independent studies that are done that are drawing the same conclusion, and that becomes a really powerful tool. And in fact, when we were going to publication, we had a third portion of this chapter that we have now put online, which you can read it at projectcensored.org and bcml.org. We talked about sort of what is going to be the impact of managing this election, because there was this excitement among millennials who participated in this election.
This is what I wanted to look at for the last segment here on this issue, is that we did research on this war on social justice and the impact on millennial generation and the way that corporate media has been very biased in their coverage against millennials. So talk about the research.
Junk food, we know, distracts from newsworthy stories, and news abuse carefully crafts narratives to manipulate public opinion. And so in this third segment that we have online, we noted that the junk food and news abuse distracted and or undermined stories of social justice. And so we specifically looked at some of these stories that are tied to contemporary youth movements, and the youth we point to are the millennial generation. And so stories, for example, of race were trivialized, stories of sexism, human rights, climate change. These stories were either ignored or trivialized to launch the candidacies of Trump and Clinton. And I found this to be a very concerning outcome of the election, because you have the millennials, these youths that are so involved with these movements, and these issues are important to them. And this generation's already been attacked for supposedly being lazy and checked out. But here they did. They participated in this election in a big way, overwhelmingly supporting Bernie Sanders. Bernie took home over 60% of the youth vote, some states 80%. It wasn't that they didn't participate. It's that their vote was completely ignored. These political parties manage the election to marginalize the youth. And so my question is, I'm very interested in the 2020 election and future elections of how the youth are going to react. By 2020, millennials are going to make up 36% of the voting populace. And so this is kind of the last round for the baby boomers to dominate our elections. It's up to kind of the millennials in 2020. And I think that's a really critical point to make, because Clinton and Trump are kind of the fruition of this baby boomer generation that turned the party of Eisenhower into the party of Trump and party of FDR into the Clinton corporate pay-to-play meritocracy. And so it's interesting to see that these baby boomers are generation is maintaining this power in these two figures, yet this challenge coming from the millennials. And that's kind of where we leave off when this election goes, is one of these candidates is going to be named the president. And it's concerning. Will millennials take this as an opportunity to organize and challenge the system and change it? Or will they become self-fulfilling and become apathetic and sort of check out of the system because they know it's managed at some level?
Nolan Higdon, the current narrative from the parties and certainly the corporate news media, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, just did a story on this the other day, and this is certainly a theme that you've been looking at for some time and that we've been looking at this particular year, both in the book, in 2017 Censored book, and online in other articles. And that's the way that it's now being spun, that somehow millennials and their lack of education and awareness or apathy is responsible for the rise of Trump, which really makes no sense at all. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, this is just laughable. Let's remind people here, this is also the generation that sort of walked off and accepted the election of George W. Bush. They now have evidence, glaring evidence, that parties and media worked to launch the candidacy of Hillary Clinton. And now they're attacking millennials, telling them they need to vote for Hillary Clinton, someone who was not elected by the people. The people were manipulated in this process.
to get her the nomination. And, you know, my advice for young people would be don't buy into the system and treat her like a legitimate candidate. Challenge her candidacy for this party manipulation. Furthermore, these candidates are coming from the generation that gave us the first two unpaid wars in U.S. history, the greatest financial collapse of the Great Depression, and deregulation and protecting against things like race inequality and gender inequality, et cetera. And then they have the audacity to tell young people how to vote. Hillary's proposing adding three more years of work to collect Social Security. So it seems like it's always shuffling everything on the youth to pay for the mistakes of this generation.
And Nolan Higdon, go ahead. Yeah. You go ahead.
Oh, yeah. My advice would be not to buy into that narrative if I was a young person. I would show up to vote to show you're not apathetic or lazy, but continue to challenge the system.
Now, Nolan, you know, Black Lives Matter, Occupy Wall Street, the Fight for 15, the youth climate movement, the Dreamers, LGBTQI, you know, a lot of these are youth movements or youth strong movements. So the notion that millennials get painted in such a stereotypical way is, as you said, laughable. But again, it's definitely inaccurate. It's definitely a ploy to marginalize young people. And as you say, the millennial generation is going to be the largest voting bloc, bigger than baby boomers, even coming up for 2020. So it's certainly going to be something that we'll be paying attention to at Project Censored, and I'm sure you'll be sort of spearheading that front.
Absolutely. I'm normally not such an optimistic person, but I'm very optimistic about this generation. Young people are getting out there. They are doing things. They are thinking in new ways. I'm optimistic about the future in this generation.
And it certainly terrifies the baby boomer power elites in both government and corporations that young people can mobilize, can engage. Certainly the CIA and the Secret Service and FBI were all over the Occupy movement, infiltrated everywhere. They're worried that millennials will, in fact, really continue to engage, and they have quite thoroughly.
Absolutely. I mean, even we have these protests that are going on in different sporting events, not just the NFL, but sporting events around the country are costing some of these major corporations billions in advertising dollars. But they're not showing these national anthems because people are turning off their television. So there's a lot of exciting things going on right now around this generation, and it is challenging our power structures. But I'd encourage youth, or remind youth, I guess, that these changes don't happen fast. These movements need to connect, they need to be sustained, and they need to continue moving forward.
Professor Nolan Higdon, you are behind the Junk Food News Abuse chapter. You worked with many students at several colleges and universities, and I worked with you on some of these works, and also a new piece that's going to be up here at ProjectCensored.org and the Global Critical Media Literacy Project at gcml.org. So listeners can go online and be looking for some of the research that we were just discussing. Nolan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you both very much. Great to hear from both of you.
Up next on the Project Censored Show, we'll speak with one of the millennial generation journalists. We'll be joined by Manar Muhawish of Mint Press News, who has contributions in Censored 2017. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program looks at Censored 2017, the 40th anniversary edition. We heard from co-editor and associate director of the project, Andy Lee Roth, who was talking about some of the top censored stories of the year. We just heard from Nolan Higdon, who helped contribute to the Junk Food News Abuse chapter. And now we're joined by Manar Muhawish. She is an independent journalist. She's the founder of Mint Press News. Manar has a story in our top 25 this year on Syria, and she's joining us today by phone to talk about her work. Manar Muhawish, thank you for joining us on the Project Censored Show today.
Thank you for having me, Mickey. Excited to be here.
So, Manar, tell us about your contribution to the book this year, particularly from Chapter 4. We do something called Media Democracy in Action. And, you know, as James Baldwin wrote, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it's faced. And the gist of this chapter each year in the books highlights the important work of independent journalists and pro-democratic organizations that really try to make a difference in the world. And this year,
year. We include Abby Martin from the Empire Files, Darcy Rakestraw, Food and Water Watch, Susan Rahman of College of Marin, a longtime contributor about service learning education, Eric Dratzer of Stop Imperialism, and Peter B. Collins, great radio host, and you, Manar Mahawish of Mint Press News. Tell our listeners about why you founded Mint Press News and how you describe what you do there.
I have a very, I guess you could say, rare perspective that we have brought to the independent media world. You know, we talk a lot about the war machine and our economy being driven by a military and war economy. But I actually grew up in Palestine and lived under Israeli occupation and apartheid, which, as you know, is funded by the United States. And I witnessed war crimes being committed against humanity. I witnessed laws that divided an entire nation based on religion. And I would go to school regularly in Palestine to kids not, you know, showing up in our classroom because they were being denied an education. They were being denied entry. They were being blocked at Israeli checkpoints. And so when I had come back to the United States, where I was actually born in the United States, when I had come back in 2001, just a few months before September 11th, I witnessed the media basically present the conflict in Palestine as this equal level playing field, you know, Muslim versus Jew. And they presented it in the narrative that we're all too familiar with, which is this religious narrative. And it was never presented in a way that exposed or explained the true historical concept of Israel being a colonialist power and an apartheid state that was committing genocide against Palestinians. And so I had watched the media basically become this lapdog for this military-industrial complex and demonizing Palestinians and Muslims alike. And of course, right after September 11th, which occurred just a couple of months after we had returned, I then again, at the age of 12 years old, witnessed the media beat the drums of war by dehumanizing Muslims and Palestinians and people of the Middle East all over again to justify war and aggression abroad. And so through these experiences, of course, I felt helpless at the time and had suffered from PTSD from living under Israeli occupation. But I also had this sense of hope that, you know, the only way that we can really change the narrative and get Americans to realize the destruction that our military is basically doing across the world is to become the media. And so that's when I took it upon myself to become a journalist, to study journalism. And that has been basically my journey to start Mint Press. And since we started Mint Press, we have really taken a huge focus on the military-industrial complex and looking at how special interests do drive policies, not only at home, but abroad.
Manar, hi, this is Peter Phillips, and it's certainly shocking that so much money, $38 billion, has just been assigned to Israel over the next 10 years. And it's just amazing to us that that helps keep that war machine alive. One of your stories made its way all the way to the top 10 this year out of a couple 300, and you were voted high, and it's story number 8 about Syria.
Wow. Thank you.
And the contest for gas delivery in Europe, and not just all Muslim sectarianism. So tell us a little bit about that story.
Well, as you know, most conflicts in the Middle East are always presented in the media as this religious sectarian war. We always hear this line that, oh, they've been killing each other for thousands of years. And it's really just a dehumanization tactic to make the people in the Middle East look really like uncivilized and killable is the way that we describe it. And so since the beginning, the onset of the Syria civil war, since 2011, when the CIA was on the ground training these anti-government protests and basically fomenting a coup there, Mint Press has actually been at the forefront of providing coverage to show that this is not a genuine revolution. Although there always, in every country, there's going to be some sort of anti-government movement, the one that we see in Syria brewing today is basically an invasion. And so we've been at the forefront of covering this story, and part of our coverage has been to look at the economic interests by the West, the corporate and bankster interests of basically sanctioning Russia's economy. Now, Russia is a major player in the BRICS nations. It's a member of the BRICS nations. And so they're obviously a major player in the gas and oil industry in the world, especially in its providing of gas for the European market. And so when we covered the conflict in Syria, we know that the United States and its allies don't just get involved for the reasons of human rights. There's always going to be an economic impetus
for these conflicts, especially at the rate that they're being involved in. And so we looked at how Russia was basically creating a gas plan with Syria and Iran to get Iranian gas into the European market. But of course, this poses a very, very huge setback for major oil producing nations like Saudi Arabia. And it also poses a huge economic threat to the current infrastructure of oil and gas producers around the world, which are basically owned by, you know, British and other Western corporations. And so we basically provided that coverage to show that the crisis in Syria is maybe on the surface it appears to be a sectarian conflict, but at the root of it, Syria has been basically the target of a proxy war between the United States and Russia to basically sanction Russia's economy, to make sure that Russia does not have a footprint in the oil and gas industry.
Manar Mahoush, you've covered many issues in the Middle East in particular, and Mint Press News has really, as you said, kind of been on the front lines of a lot of these stories. And you yourself have, in fact, been the target of critics both left and right. And the fact that you are, you know, a millennial generation, a woman, also Muslim, that seems to have contributed to some of the attacks that you've experienced and efforts to censor you.
Right. I mean, how often do we hear Muslim women are oppressed, they're non-intelligent, they can't speak up for themselves, and here we are in the U.S., there's this Muslim woman wearing hijab, and she's standing up to the corporate empire, providing an alternative perspective on what's really happening in the Middle East. And I actually found myself to be a victim of an organized smear campaign a couple of years ago that was conducted against me by the most notorious neocons in the industry that are basically the architects of war within the media. You know, I was targeted by BuzzFeed, one of their major reporters, Rosie Gray. It's known to push Russia-phobia and Cold War rhetoric as well as Islamophobia, and she's very much tied to these neocon think tanks. A lot of her coverage comes directly from the National Endowment and other military think tanks that work very close with other neocons like Michael Wise, who now runs The Daily Beast, and Ellie Lake, and now the new editor of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg. And so these are the very people who are pushing this Cold War rhetoric to put the United States up against war with Russia, the next Cold War. And Mint Press News, as an independent media organization, we took it upon ourselves to challenge that narrative. And it became literally a David and Goliath kind of situation where our coverage on Syria has made international headlines, and it helped stop the initial U.S. war in Syria a few years ago when Assad had supposedly crossed that red line by gassing his own people. And, of course, we said that, hey, it's the rebels, the Syrian rebels, Al-Qaeda rebels very specifically, who have the capabilities to produce sarin gas. And they're trying to flip the narrative that Assad is killing his own people. And we provided that alternative coverage to challenge that.
Well, Manar, again, this isn't to say that Assad hasn't been behind other atrocities or other things in Syria. This is one of the big fallacies that goes on, is that because you go and attempt to really get the facts behind these issues, and you don't play into the exterior narrative, the binaries, right? Because you say some of the things you say, there's this strange assumption that you're pro-Assad, and then by definition and connection and guilt by association, you must be pro-Putin. So right. I guess if we follow that narrative, if you're pro-Putin, you must be pro-Trump.
That's really how the narrative has been playing out if you challenge these war narratives. I didn't say that very specifically, but that's what it is you get labeled as if you are pro-Assad and pro-Putin. Of course, these are just like any other leaders. They've committed their own crimes. There's always going to be corruption in their governments. And we're not saying that they're not. We're just saying that, hey, there's more to the story that's not being told.
Mint Press is certainly one of many hundreds of independent news sources throughout the world. I require my students to subscribe to independent news sources on a daily basis. Tell us about how you started Mint Press and what areas do you focus on?
Mint Press really actually started out as my blog when I was freelancing. And like I was saying before, one of the true reasons I started Mint Press is because I lived under the war machine in Israel and Palestine, and I witnessed those crimes being committed against an unarmed population. And just watching the media continuously feeding us with this junk food news
top 10 headlines of this or top 10 stories of this, it really, really encouraged me to start my own media organization to challenge corporate media. Today, we do have six corporations that control over 90% of what Americans see, hear, and read. And that's not an exaggeration. Most people get their news from these major organizations, and they don't even realize that they're being fed public relations. And so knowing that what we're getting is public relations, that really inspired me to get Mint Press started and really focus on long-form journalism. We do have some daily news, but our main focus is long-form journalism because right now we have a lot of snippets in that junk food-style news. It doesn't really have any depth to it. And so now is the time to kind of take a step back and say the media that we have now is not truly working in the interest of the public. We need to go back and really provide a journalism, a platform that really informs the public to really equip us, the American public, with the information that we need to make better decisions at the voting polls. I mean, look where we have now. We have Donald Trump, who is a sexual predator. He's a racist. And then we have Hillary Clinton, who is a war criminal and who's a liar for a living. These are our two options. And a lot of that has to do with our complicity in this. And not to put all the blame on us, the people, but it's the media that is feeding us these two candidates, and it's time that we put the power back in our hands through education, through real information, so that we can hold our government accountable, I guess you could say.
Manar Mahalish, you are speaking at the Project Censored 40th Anniversary Celebration and Media Freedom Summit, and you'll be in conversation with Abby Martin of the Empire Files, David Talbot, the founder of Salon.com, also best-selling author of The Devil's Chessboard on Alan Dulles and the CIA. Also, Mark Crispin Miller, the New York University scholar, will be joining in that conversation. Mark Crispin Miller wrote the foreword for Censored 2017 this year. So October 21st, that's the Project Censored anniversary, and that will be recorded for people to see later. But if you're local to Northern California, you should come to Sonoma State University for that event. You can learn more at projectcensored.org. The Friday night celebration is 5 to 8:30, and the October 21st, 22nd conference is all day Friday, Saturday at Sonoma State University with a detailed list of panels and workshops and speakers. It's a very participatory happening, celebrating media freedom, celebrating critical media literacy education, and the great independent journalists like yourself, Manar, and the work that you do and Abby Martin does and so many other people. People can get more information at projectcensored.org, and students are admitted to the summit for free. We want to stress that. We want to see a lot of young people, millennials and students, come out and really be part of this. Project Censored for 40 years has been a lot about education, has been a lot about trying to help another generation of citizen journalists and people do what you just described, Manar, speaking truth to power, and speaking truth is power. And we thank you so much for the work that you do at Mint Press News. Manar Mahalish, could you tell our listeners how to find out more about Mint Press News?
They can visit our website, of course, at mintpressnews.com, and then we're very active on social media, so we have our Facebook page and also our Twitter page at both Mint Press News.
Mint Press News. So thank you very much, Manar Mahalish, and we're certainly looking forward to the Media Freedom Summit and celebration on October 21st.
Thank you.
And for the final segment of the Project Censored show today, we're joined by the intrepid independent journalist Greg Palast. He is talking about a re-release, an updated version of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which is a book by Seven Stories Press, as well as a documentary film. Greg Palast, tell us about what's going on in your world.
This is a film for Full Run in San Francisco. 1,000 members of KPFA jammed in for a single night to see The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, A Tale of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. That was back in Oakland. That was just a preview with an unfinished film. Now you got the full thing, brand new. This is, by the way, a fundraiser for KPFA. It's at the Presidio Theater for 1 week. And the film features, even though it's a so-called documentary, because it's a nonfiction film, we're in the Documentary Academy Award category, It is featuring Rosario Dawson, Shailene Woodley, you know, the star of Snowden. Willie Nelson's in there. Ice-T is in there. So is Richard Belzer. That is Detective Munch, who comes out. The Belzer and Ice-T in their roles from Law & Order pop out of a TV screen to help me on my investigation into the theft of the November election. You say, what? Yep, I've got the info. I've got the documents. I've got the inside stuff. And I confront the billionaires who have paid for this heist in November. Remember, Donald Trump only plays a billionaire on TV. The real billionaires behind him, like JP the Foreclosure King and the Vulture, these are real billionaires who are funding this vote heist. You'll see how it's done. It'll make you laugh. It'll make you cry. It'll make you act. If you don't laugh and cry, I personally will pay for your therapy. Got a standing ovation from 1,000 KPFA subscribers who saw the film before it was even finished a few weeks ago in Oakland. Now it's the real thing at a regular theater with surround sound, the whole bit, music by Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Mario Grigoroff. Lots of fun, lots of horror.
So these showings of your film, Best Democracy Money Can Buy, are going to be at the Presidio Theater in San Francisco tonight, October 14th through next Thursday, October 20th. And you're going to be there in person this weekend at
That's
the 4:30 and 7 o'clock showings.
That's right. We're going to have a lot of your KPFA celebs. We'll definitely have Dennis Bernstein, Jello Biafra, and we've invited my special guest, Boots Riley, the crew, and others. And obviously we have some superstars from the film. And usually one or two sneak in. I got Jackson Brown in the other day. We'll have some good people, but more important, the best people in the world who are KPFA listeners and supporters and subscribers. We are taking the proceeds from this showing for KPFA, your weapon of mass destruction, in the Bay Area. Most important, it's not the usual documentary. It's not the Petroleum Broadcast System documentary of white guys in front of bookshelves. It is on-the-go, real undercover investigative reporting done in real time, including shots taken from a camera sewn into my hat. I'm always wearing a hat. It's not made up. None of this stuff is made up. It's a 100% true film. People keep saying, what's made up? Nothing, except for Santa Claus. There is no Santa Claus. It's actually Ed Asner in a Santa outfit who's explaining how JP, the Foreclosure King's, Donald Trump's money bags fixed the mortgage market to personally swipe $5 billion.
Greg Palast, we're going to have to cut it there, and we encourage people to see The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Greg, can you give a website so people can find out more?
Yeah, always go to gregpalast.com, G-R-E-G-P-A-L-A-S-T, gregpalast.com, or thebestdemocracymoneycanbuy.com. That's a little longer. GregPalast.com, it'll tell you where. It'll refresh your mind that this is at the Presidio at the 4:30 and 7 p.m. showings. I'll be there all weekend. It'll be playing all week, four times a day. Please get there. This is for your station, KPFA, but more important, it's for you, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, a tale of billionaires and ballot bandits. You couldn't get more sickened while having more fun.
Greg Palast, thanks for coming back on the Project Censored show, and wish you all the best.
You got it.
That's The Best Democracy Money Can Buy at Presidio Theater, 2340 Chestnut Street in San Francisco.
Not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored show today. I'd like to make a couple of quick announcements. One is the Project Censored 40th Anniversary and Media Freedom Summit that will be held at Sonoma State University October 21st and 22nd. That's at Sonoma State University in Rohnert Park, California. You can learn more at projectcensored.org. There is a Friday night celebration that's open to the public with Abby Martin, Manar Mahawish, Mark Crispin Miller, and David Talbot. Go online to projectcensored.org to find out more and register for the conference, a two-day event celebrating and discussing media freedom. Students are admitted for free. Also, I'll be hosting Ralph Nader in the Bay Area. That would be Monday, October 17th at St. John's Church at 7:30 p.m. You can learn more at kpfa.org. I'll also be hosting Ralph Nader at Diablo Valley College, where I teach Tuesday afternoon, October 18th, in the Diablo Room. The Project Censored Show airs on 35 stations around the United States. To learn more, you can go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Special thanks goes to our producer, Anthony Fest, Erica Bridgman, our engineer. We'll see you next time. Up next, Terra Verde.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Julia Witte, For Love and Protection of the Deep Ocean. How does the entertainment industry form our understanding of people and events? In the fall of 2016, the movie Deepwater Horizon grossed $65 million worldwide in the first few weeks. The film contains heroic action, fire, and explosions on that drilling rig in the Gulf of Mexico. The only animals harmed are two prehistoric-looking birds colliding with wind shields. No mention of the impact of at least 210 million gallons of oil spilled into the ocean and onto the coastline. The toxic dispersant used in that summer of 2010 and the persisting harm caused under the surface of the sea in the deep ocean. Julia Witte is environmental correspondent for Mother Jones and reported on a diving investigation right after the Deepwater Horizon exploded. I met her at a book release party soon after her return and asked her a few questions after her reading. Here's a rebroadcast of the program I produced. I met Julia Witte in August 2010, immediately after Carol Browner, the White House Energy and Climate Advisor, had claimed that the vast majority of oil that had poured into the Gulf of Mexico for almost 3.5 months had already disappeared. In a small Northern California town where she lives, Julia Witte was giving a reading from her new book, Deep Blue Home, An Intimate Ecology of Our Wild Ocean. The book had been described as breathtakingly learned and lyrical, written with humor, reverence, and curiosity. Julia Witte is a diver, former nature documentary filmmaker, author, and investigative journalist. As environmental correspondent for Mother Jones, she had just returned from the Gulf Coast. She wrote, BP and its partners' reckless quest has endangered and perhaps condemned not just the Gulf Coast, but the largest, richest, most pristine, most biologically important, and last completely unprotected ecosystem left on Earth, the deep ocean. On that night in early August, Julia Witte explained why the deep ocean is the foundation of life for the upper layer of the sunlit sea. Many whales, dolphins, seals, sea turtles, sharks, and smaller predatory fish are nocturnal hunters, dependent on the movements of a vast community of organisms that live in the deep ocean. That community is known only since the 1920s as the deep scattering layer. And this deep scattering layer that rises and falls with day and night, and that is visited by the creatures of the sunlit sea, is threatened by the invisible part of the gigantic outpour of oil that never came to the surface because it was hit by chemical dispersants, and now doubly invisible by the White House claim that 75% has already disappeared. But researchers and divers report on huge clouds of dispersed oil and of dissolved natural gas and methane that remain below the surface and now move around the Gulf. These toxic clouds are separating the creatures of the deep ocean from those in the twilight and sunlit zones. And wherever the clouds of oil and gas move in, the creatures from above and below have to travel through the poisonous brew twice in one day to survive. I begin this program with a reading by Julia Witte from Deep Blue Home, followed by her comments on the BP oil spill. The reading is introducing the deep scattering layer in an indirect way. A whale is sinking to the bottom of the sea, and that journey from sun to twilight to perpetual darkness introduces you to the creatures of another world. Julia Witte.
Countless millions of whales once churned the sunlit waters of the world, some scouring the seafloor for buried mollusks, some chasing capelin up from the deep, some corralling krill, some wrestling giant squid. Yet these cumulative actions of their daily lives in no way marked the sum of their services in the world, which persisted far beyond the span of their own existence into the fetch of the future. Like old-growth trees that fall and die and spend centuries nourishing a forest with the fruits of their rot, so the great whales sink to the bottom of the sea to nourish the oceans with their decay. A great whale's death journey to the bottom of the sea is accelerated or braked by the presence or absence of fat in its body. Lean, starved whales fall faster than fatter whales. Regardless, the downward journey takes place in the slow motion of the underwater world as the processes of decomposition produce buoyant gases that duel with the force of gravity in such a way that the carcass rides a gentle elevator up and down on its way down. a sperm whale off the Galapagos, a gray whale in the Gulf of California, a humpback off Newfoundland, all become part of the windfall that descends from the surface to the collapsed depths of the abyss. The first visitors to arrive at the deathbed of most whales are the swimmers of the pelagic ocean, the torpedo-like mako sharks, blue sharks, silky sharks, tuna, and billfish, who tear at the carcasses, opening it for the big fish with small mouths, and for the smaller fish with big mouths, and for all the tiny planktonic predators who will join the dead whale on the elevator ride up and down. Later, the bulkier scavengers, tigers, and great white sharks will work their way across scores or even hundreds of miles of ocean to join the whale's vertical migration. In the ink-black waters below 600 feet, the mesopelagic community begins to attach itself to the carcass of a great whale, the barracudinas, the cross-toothed perches, the myriad of squid, the lanternfish, and lancetfish. When a falling whale enters their world, a world the whale might well have fed upon her entire life, those who were her prey gathered to feast upon her remains. Many of these dwellers of the middle sea possess extraordinarily large eyes and a series of light-producing organs known as photophores. Hidden within perpetual darkness, these fish produce weak blue, green, or yellow lights whose colors and patterns reveal the individual's species and gender, as well as information shared for the purpose of shoaling and other communications we can't understand. The photophores, controlled by internal dimmer switches, also create a camouflage known as counter-illumination, so that those dining on the falling whale are as good as invisible against the faint glow from above. Pushed and prodded by a ravening army of razor blades and cutlasses, the whale slips into the bathypelagic zone below 3,000 feet. Here, the pressures of the depths are greater than 100 times those at the surface, squeezing the buoyant decomposition gases from the tissues of the whale once and for all, so that now her inexorable path is downward only. The carcass begins to fold and even break at the weak joints, the first stages of the flattening of the deep. New fish appear, animals missing parts seemingly vital to existence in our world, such as hearts, brains, kidneys, muscles, scales, eyes, gills, skeletons. Some of these dwellers of the profound sea are endowed with the ability to eat three times their body weight, stuffing whale meat into distensible stomachs until their bellies dwarf their bodies, as if upside-down hot air balloons were dangling below the tiny gondolas of their backs and fins. Some, like gulper eels, become little more than floating jaws with cellophane bags for bodies, a plan designed to maximize the one and only meal that may come their way in a year. Odd gelatinous anglerfish approach, the females casting with the fishing tackle attached to their foreheads, complete with rods, lines, luminescent lures, and sometimes hooks. Their male partners take the form of tiny parasitical appendages attached by their jaws to the female skin, where they subsist on embryo-like connections to her blood supply. Thus conjoined, the males atrophy to nothing more than gonads, awaiting the moment to spawn. Finally, hours or even days after death, the whale finds the soft bottom of the sea and settles into the muck, where it becomes an island for the migrations of sleeper sharks, king crabs, and hagfish. These scavengers are joined over time by the slower-moving migrant feeders of the abyss, sea cucumbers, sea stars, brittle stars, burrowing urchins, and worms, who caravan between the feeding stations of large things fallen from the surface, the big whales, big fish, big tree trunks, and huge mats of kelp and other vegetation blown offshore by storms. On the vast desert of the ocean floor, a whale fall is an unexpected oasis, literally dropping out of the blue and providing a nutritional bonanza of a magnitude that might otherwise take thousands of years to accumulate from the background flow of small detritus from the surface. A 35-ton gray whale takes 1.5 years to be stripped to the bone by the scalpels and stomachs of the deep. A 160-ton blue whale might take as many as 11 years. Yet even beyond that, even after a dead whale's organic matter appears to have been completely devoured, the blubber-saturated sediments surrounding the bone support dense populations of chemosynthesizing bacteria and microbes. When nothing is left but the skeleton, the bones themselves become fuel for a preternatural whalefall community, including osedaks, or bone-eating worms, which consist mostly of roots that bore into the skeleton to extract its proteins. Bone-eating worms are aided in their work by symbiotic single-celled bacteria able to fuel themselves on the organic carbon of the dead whale. Thanks to these bacteria, osedaks survive without any gut whatsoever. And they are only one example among the strange wonders of abyssal oases, where much of the primary production is done by chemoautotrophic organisms that make life from non-life using chemistry, not sunlight. In a world without eyes, unseen by any living thing, the dead whale becomes a shadow atop the shadow of the bottom of the world, living in its after-death for another 100 years, maybe more.
That was Julia Witte reading from her new book, Deep Blue Home. I asked her about the breaking news of the day that the White House had announced that the well was capped and most of the oil had already disappeared.
They're trying to spin it right now that, hey, it's all done. You know, hey, look, it's mostly gone. It's all been weathered. And we've been lied to about this thing more or less from the beginning. You know, the reality is, I talked about those the fish that have the light organs, the photophores that they signal with. And they are the dominant fish in a community that lives in the ocean. It's the largest biomass of life on Earth. It's known as the deep scattering layer. And it's a huge aggregation of life forms that lives below the cusp of perpetual darkness in the ocean, which means during the daytime, they're down below light, usually below 1,000 feet. And they rise with sunset, and they rise with night, just below the edge of night, until by nightfall, they are up at the surface. And virtually everything we know of the sunlit sea, the whales, the dolphins, most of the fish we eat or catch, you know, the seabirds, the turtles, the sharks, the billfish, the predatory fish, most of them make their living hunting the deep scattering layer. Virtually all of them are nocturnal hunters that wait for this great dumb waiter of sea flute to rise from the deep every night, and they either dive down to meet it. Some of them even specialize on diving down and catching it in the day, making extremely deep dives. Because down in the cold water at those depths of 3,000 or so feet, a lot of these creatures of the deep scattering layer, which are fish and squid and all kinds of zooplankton, a lot of them enter a state akin to sleep. It's almost like a little mini hibernation that goes on. They become torpid in the cold, slows their metabolism down, and they get to use less energy. And actually, ecologists have worked out that it makes more sense for many of these animals to swim the human equivalent of 25 miles up to the surface, feed all night in productive surface waters that are fueled by the plant plankton, the phytoplankton that are fueled by sunlight, and then swim the human equivalent of 25 miles back down into the deep and spend the day in the cold, barely running, shut down kind of like little yogis down there. You know, they've got everything shut way down. And it's more effective for them to do that. That was a long-winded way of getting to the problem that I see, the biggest problem in the Gulf of Mexico with what has happened is the fact that from the very beginning, BP was hitting that wellhead at 5,000 feet deep with chemical dispersants. And the problem is they took what was a source point of pollution of a buoyant pollutant, namely oil, that would really have risen to the surface where it could have been skimmed or scooped, right? And what they did was they hit it at the wellhead, they dispersed it so effectively that it's now formed these vast underwater plumes that are in essence neutrally buoyant, may never ever rise to the surface, will never be collectible, can never be brought back in. And it's down there, and this huge foundational biomass of the ocean, the deep scattering layer, has to migrate through these plumes twice a day. Well, what does that tell you? And already some of the people who are looking at this are finding that these plumes are trapping the deep scattering layer. I mean, I've talked with researchers who've been diving out there, and researchers who've dived down in clear water, done their work on the bottom for 30 minutes, and on their way up, they've encountered oil that moved in, a plume that moved in, and they've had to come up through oil. the deep scattering layer, these animals are going to be trapped beneath the plumes and unable to get up to the surface to feed, or they're going to have gotten up there and be trapped and unable to get back away from the predators of the day who are going to come out and get them. And it's also mixed with dispersant, which very well may be more toxic than either the oil or the dispersant alone. So it's a pretty dreadful situation, and you know the bottom line as to why did BP hit the wellhead with all this dispersant. And the truth is, they know, based on the Exxon Valdez reality, that their legal liability is going to depend on somewhere between $1,000 and about $4,500 per barrel of legal liability for oil spilled. And if they hit that oil at the wellhead, who's going to say how much oil ever came out of that thing? So it's a way of disguising the real truth of how much oil came out of that reservoir before they capped it. That's the only explanation, and it's essentially a criminal act, in my opinion. The problem is the Gulf of Mexico was already one of the most stressed-out ocean ecosystems on Earth. Many endangered species barely holding on. We know that about 1,600 sperm whales live in the northern Gulf of Mexico, maybe never leave, that they feed on squid in the deep scattering layer. And they specifically feed in an area right in the Mississippi Canyon, right around the Deepwater Horizon wellhead. We know that critically endangered western bluefin tuna would have spawned in the Gulf right around the Deepwater Horizon wellhead at the time of the blowout. And we also know that the adults are very deep divers, and they dive down into the deep scattering layer in the daytime. They make dives of over 3,000 feet deep in search of critters of the deep scattering layer. Some of these species and some of these ecosystems may never recover from these assaults that have been launched as a result of this really reckless pirating of the deep. We don't even look at what we're doing down there. There's no environmental impact statement for the deep sea floor out there. And, you know, we just act like it doesn't matter. And I hope this will change that. The one positive that might come out of this is that we'll actually reconsider the ocean beyond our sight, the horizon far from shore, and the deep water column that really supports all the life of the ocean that we love so much. There's about 30,000 holes punched in the floor of the Gulf of Mexico. 27,000 of them are abandoned wells that are mostly not being monitored. You know, whether they've been sealed up properly, whether they're still leaking. Hurricane Katrina, when it came through, popping well heads off and knocking over containers and rupturing pipeline, there's 30,000 miles of pipeline underlying the Gulf of Mexico that's carrying all this oil and natural gas from these holes in the seafloor to shore. Hurricane Katrina actually caused an estimated 8 million gallons of oil spill, which is just slightly shy of the Exxon Valdez. And a recent study shows that, in fact, all this pipeline is extremely vulnerable to hurricane force waves down to about 300 feet. The waves have enough power to undermine the seafloor, causing seafloor collapses that could break the pipeline. So, you know, we have to really think about when we look at our future and when we look at the true costs of oil, the real cost of oil, how expensive cheap oil really, really is. And hopefully this, again, is something we'll take a look at as we move forward and make collective decisions about our future and what we want it to look like. I think the dispersed plumes of oil, which are neutrally buoyant and bobbing around in the water column, there isn't much we can do about those, really. Ideally, we would make it illegal to ever use chemical dispersants again and make that stick somehow. That would be issue number one. For the marshlands that lie at the mouth of the Mississippi River, the Louisiana marshlands, which was where most of the television coverage and most of the print media coverage was focused, and those marshlands are basically the womb of the Gulf of Mexico. It's the nursery ground for everything, all the fish and shellfish and oysters, and you name it, almost all of it happens in those marshlands. Those marshlands were under terrible threat before the oil spill. And they were losing something like a football field every 30 minutes. So the best thing we could do for that area, the womb of the ocean, to allow these larval, teeny little fish to go in and have their little babyhood in the protected nursery of the marshes, would be to open the floodgates of the Mississippi River. So if you look at Google Earth images or satellite images of the mouth of the Mississippi River, it doesn't look natural, and it isn't, because we've basically taken the river and we're driving it through canals that are shooting it very fast right past the marshlands out into the deep water. So this enables all the shipping of the Mississippi to come and go easily, and they don't have to worry about navigating, you know, shifting shoals and sandbars and all those treacherous things that lie at the mouths of big rivers. But it's been at the cost of these marshlands, which rely on the sediment. They rely on the decomposing landmass of North America that gets, you know, run downstream on the flowing waters to be deposited in the delta. This would help, first of all, remediate the problems of the oil spill, because the only thing that's going to really happen eventually is sediment is going to overlie the oil and just bury it into that geological layer. So those would be two important things. No more dispersant and open the floodgates of the Mississippi. Those would help remediate not only this problem, but a lot of other problems that have been plaguing the Gulf of Mexico. I don't like to fall to pessimism, because then you just quit. So I prefer to keep, you know, working and trying to think of ways, and I honestly believe that we have it in our power to change all of these things. We actually know the answers. It's not like we're sitting there scratching our heads going, God, what do we do about that? We know exactly what to do about all of these problems, and it really is a matter of collective will and, to a large extent, political will. And we have to remember that the only way we can turn the ship, however slowly and laboriously the ship is moving towards this dreadful future, I mean, it's only us that are at the helm. And, you know, we can crank that damn wheel over and reverse course. So, again, part of the reason I write about these things and I talk about these things is hoping to contribute to everyone's commitment to continuing to do whatever we all can do to make sure that these changes are made.
That was Julia Witte, author, diver, documentary filmmaker, and environmental correspondent for Mother Jones. I'm ending this program with another reading from her new book, Deep Blue Home. This is a report from one of her underwater filming expeditions.
We encounter the peculiar handiwork of modern hunters in drenching sleet on a desolate Newfoundland shoreline. The sky wafts among us, ghosts of icy mist that cling, pass through, and drape over, separating us from each other as if we've drifted into different universes. Some of these fingers are cold enough that we can hear the crackling of ice crystals tapping at our neoprene hoods. As quickly as we can, we lurch toward the water, stumbling not just from the cold and dark, but from the phantoms here. This small beach, composed of rocks and pebbles, is now obscured by bones. Thousands and thousands of rostra, scapulae, ribs, phalanges, vertebrae, crania, and mandibles, the remains of some of the 54,000 long-finned pilot whales killed in the Newfoundland dry fishery between 1947 and 1971. We struggle to walk on such uneven pavement, slick with ice and green with algae, and are grateful to flop forward at the water's edge, only to find the horror magnified underwater as our faceplates skim bare inches above the seafloor. The beach may be overflowing with disassembled skeletons, yet it's only a veneer compared to what lies beneath the waves, as if a cargo container holding all the bones of the world had broken apart offshore and washed up here. These last surviving pieces of the whales have been rolled by the waves, their edges tumbled and polished into homogeneity, the sea mixing and matching once separate animals, males with females, calves with adults, relatives with rivals. The water is 44 degrees, as cold as a cod's nose, according to Peter, who does not join us in its shocking embrace. The water is clear enough to award us an unhindered picture of the sloping seabed and its mountains of skeletons. We swim to the left and to the right and offshore and never find an end to the bones. It's a mausoleum of marble, utterly silent, except for the radio static of snapping shrimp, a eulogy broadcast from the past. Strange sentries abound among the bones, some so bone-like they appear to be bones, invisible at first and then unmistakable. Squat, homely fish with horn-like spines around bulbous eyes, broad heads tapering to folded tails, backs prickly with spines. They are short-horned sculpins, whom the Newfoundlanders call horny whores. Their mouths are wide, down-set, thick-lipped, grumpy. Yet ugliness is part of the sculpin's superb design, allowing these fish to open their mouths wide enough to swallow anything and everything that wanders by. Crabs, capelin, sea stars, amphipods, marine worms, including prey nearly their own size. Stealth is their hook, followed by speed. When I swim too close, a sculpin grunts and jumps off its perch, pectoral fins folded tight to its body, and lands on a nearby bone. When I keep coming, it sashays resolutely away, undulating to the left and the right with each bat-like flap of its wings. It's a simple world, characteristic of the high latitudes, where species become fewer and ecosystems more concise. But it's also haunted by what used to be and no longer is, by the 60,000 long-finned pilot whales who once summered off Newfoundland.
That was an excerpt from Deep Blue Home, read by the author Julia Whitty. She is a diver, documentary filmmaker, and environmental correspondent for Mother Jones. I filmed her in August 2010 in the small Northern California town of Sebastopol, where she lives. Come back when TUC Radio returns for stories on minke whales, icebergs, and a free-ranging conversation with Julia Whitty. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gleiden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. New Bedford, Massachusetts, a seaport located in the southeast corner of Massachusetts, at the base of Cape Cod, is the locale of our program. Early in New Bedford's history, a group of Quakers from Boston moved there. New Bedford soon became a safe haven for formerly enslaved African Americans who had been able to escape bondage in the South. The stories of those who safely arrived in New Bedford on the Underground Railroad are presented at the 34-acre New Bedford National Historical Park in the Old Town section of New Bedford. This two-part series on the New Bedford Underground Railroad with National Park Ranger Mark Mello was recorded on September 2, 2016, with the sounds of wind and street traffic in the background. Part one begins with a historical perspective of the Underground Railroad and the way in which New Bedford, Massachusetts became a safe haven for former slaves.
talk about the Underground Railroad, obviously we're not going underground today. We're not talking about a literal railroad. Basically, a loose connection of people, places, businesses, homes. We're going to attempt to get fugitive slaves from down south, ideally to the Canadian border. What a lot of people do not realize is not until you hit that Canadian border are you truly free. Well, there was no slavery in the north. Yes, but that did not mean that northerners were above sending you back into slavery. You have a percentage of people called abolitionists in America, people who believe that slavery is morally wrong. Make up less than 1% of your population in the early 19th century. Most of your northerners at the time are indifferent towards the issue of slavery. Thus, the reason why you can travel just a couple miles out to either Dartmouth or Freetown, any of the surrounding towns, you'll still find houses where there are hidden rooms where they hid fugitive slaves. Why? Well, in the town of Freetown, there's one African-American man living there in the 19th century. You're going to stick out like a sore thumb if you're a fugitive slave. Thus, the reason why you need to hide and only travel at night. This city, though, was different. There's no hidden rooms, no secret passageways in the city. That is the remarkable thing about it. In this city, a slave could hide in plain sight. Why is that, you might be asking? Well, we'll talk a little bit about that at our first stop down on Water Street.
Across the street right here.
So standing on this very spot some 150 years ago, that is what you would have seen looking down there to the waterfront. Wow. Hundreds of thousands of barrels of whale oil lining the waterfront. But how do we get to this point? Well, our story starts with the lovely people who come over in the Mayflower in the 1620s, right? The pilgrims. In search of religious freedom, right? At least we're told in history they're looking for that religious freedom and that religious liberty. Problem. One of the ironic twists in history is that people in search of religious freedom were not going to guarantee it to others who came here. Other early groups to this area are the Baptists, people called Quakers or Friends. And basically, when these people get here, they're faced with an ultimatum from the Plymouth authorities and the Puritan authorities up in Boston. Convert or get out. The Quakers are going to be very important for our story today. The Quakers don't want to give up that religion that they have. They are Christians. They have a lot of interesting beliefs. Not a lot of people are familiar with them today. I always tell people, think of that guy in the Quaker oats, the oatmeal box. Typical Quaker garb. Very traditional people. Frugal when it comes to money. But they have some very important beliefs, which is very important for our story about the Underground Railroad. Amongst them is that Quakers believe that every man is his own minister. And every man has a right to interpret the Bible as he so chooses. You don't need a middleman between you and God. But with that, there's a very strong tenet in the Quaker community of equality. So right from the very beginning, the abolitionist population is very small, but a lot of those abolitionists are going to be Quakers. So big deal. Quakers are abolitionists. So what? What does that mean for New Bedford? Well, when they get here and Plymouth authorities tell them convert or get out, they start to spread out. A lot of them go to a small island not too far away from here. I'm sure you've all heard of it, Nantucket. They settle there, and that is where Quakers are going to really start to build the whaling industry in the United States of America, is on that island of Nantucket. Others are going to go down to Providence, Rhode Island. Some of you may be familiar with the story of Roger Williams. He founds Providence on the idea of religious tolerance. But even Roger Williams doesn't like the Quakers. And he basically tells him, you know, you can stay here if you want, but I think you'd be better served moving to an island not too far away from here in what we would call Newport today. So a lot of Quakers settled there as well. But there's a problem for these spread-out Quakers, especially the ones who stay on the mainland. War breaks out between the Native Americans and the colonists here in the 1670s. Spread-out Quakers, easy pickings for Native American attacks. So what do? Congregate, right? Power in numbers. And one of the first areas where they are going to congregate is right in this area. It will come to be known as Old Dartmouth. In one settlement, would be right here on the shores of the Acushnet River where we now stand today. Well, why is that important? Well, one gentleman over in Nantucket, he's a whaling merchant, he's a Quaker. And he's sitting back and he's thinking, hey, this isn't a good place to be for this industry. A man by the name of Roach says, hey, there's got to be a better place to go. He's looking. He looks for Quaker settlements. He sees this little place called Old Dartmouth. He sees a little settlement on the shores of the Acushnet River. So the port here is protected from the ocean, not exposed to the Atlantic. We're on a river. It's a deep river. Perfect for heavy laden down ships. Ample supplies of trees to build ships. Ample supply of farmland to supply these ships. Seems like a no-brainer, right? And that's what Roach thinks, too. I'm going to go to modern New Bedford. And slowly, more of his colleagues over there in Nantucket start to go, hey, he might have a point. And more are going to come here. And slowly, it'll build and build to the point where, in the 1850s, this is the richest city in the world. Because of the whaling industry. Kind of remarkable. But why is that important for a fugitive slave? So what? Well, what did I say about Quaker beliefs? A lot of them are abolitionists. And who are most of the merchants here in the city? Quakers. Good rule of thumb in history. Where money lies, so too does the power. Guess who runs this city? Quakers. So right from the very beginning, the foundation of this city is built upon those Quaker ideals. And should a fugitive come to us in need of help, who are we to say no to him? So that is the atmosphere created right from the very beginning in the city. Another reason, though, why this becomes the perfect place for a fugitive slave to come. And the answer is right down there at the waterfront, the whaling industry. Come the 1800s, the time period in which we're talking about, Atlantic whales have been overhunted. They still exist, but they are tougher to find. So you think about it. When you go fishing, where do you go? Place where you know there's a lot of fish, or where you might not catch anything? You're going to go to where you know you can catch something. Same idea here. Where are all the whales? In the Pacific and the Indian Oceans. Problem though, right? We're here in New Bedford. We're not on the Pacific Ocean, are we? No. So how do we get there? We either have to travel around South America or around Africa. That voyage will take you 3 to 5 months, at least, assuming you hit good weather. No whale ship ever made can hold enough of supplies to last you 3 to 5 months. But if it takes you 3 to 5 months to get over there, how long is it going to take you to get back? The same amount of time, right? So it's almost a year in just voyaging to and from the fishing grounds. So in order to catch enough of whales to fill up your ship, you're going to need to stay there for 3 to 5 years. So you need to resupply your ship, not only with goods, but a lot of times, merchants, to try to get cheaper labor, would leave here with just enough of men to get the ship out of harbor and out to sea. And they travel across the Atlantic, following the Gulf Stream over to the Azores, islands off the coast of Portugal, Cape Verde, island off of Africa, the African continent itself. And there, with these island people who are experienced fishermen, we're going to take them onto our ship as crew members. Also, whaling stinks. It's not a pleasant way to make a living. And a lot of those Yankee farm boys who decide, oh, this is a great idea, get to a place like the Hawaiian Islands and realize Hawaii looks an awful lot better than that whale ship you're on. So they desert, they jump ship. We need the crew members, though, so where are you bringing them on? Hawaii, the Polynesian Islands, all those places. Whaling's also very dangerous. You're losing people along the way. So you're resupplying not only in goods, but with people. Guess where they all come back to? Right here. What happens to the diversity of this city, then? It explodes. Freetown in the 1800s, you only see one African-American man. You can walk these city streets in New Bedford in the 1800s and see almost different, every different race, ethnicity, culture, hear almost every different language, eat almost any kind of food, all on these city streets. Anybody a Moby Dick fan? There's usually one or two in the crowd. In that book, there is one chapter entitled The Street. You're standing on the street that Herman Melville wrote about in the book. And in that chapter, Melville goes as far as to say that there are cannibals who stand on the corners in New Bedford. Again, illustrating to us the diversity which exists in this city. You're a fugitive slave. Are you going to stick out? No. You can blend into the crowd here, and nobody will ever know the difference. Now, I bring you here for one final reason. And that is because the waterfront proved a major way of fugitive slaves getting into the city. And there's one story of a man by the name of Joseph Smith. Smith's a slave down in the Carolinas, works on a plantation, small plantation, only 30 to 40 slaves on it. One day, a buddy of his, who's also a slave, works in the city, comes back with news that there is a ship in the harbor destined for a city of New Bedford. And not much is known about that city, beside the fact that they claim to be welcoming of fugitive slaves. Smith makes the decision that, hey, I'm going to stow away, and I'm going to try to run away from slavery. Makes his way up the eastern seaboard on this lumber ship, stowed away below deck. Finds himself right down on State Pier, which is just on the other side of this row of buildings. Looks a little different today than it did back then, but it's still called State Pier. And he steps up out of the ship, and he looks up onto these very streets that we're now standing in. And what does he see? Thousands of people. Hundreds of barrels of oil lining the waterfront. Amongst those thousands of people up here, though, he sees people of all different colors. He sees carriages going up and down the streets. Maybe he sees a prim and proper Quaker elite merchant walking down the street. You want to talk about culture shock, ladies and gentlemen? This is a man who's only come in contact with less than 60 people in his entire life, and now he sees this. How would you feel? Can you imagine what he must have been going through? Make matters worse for him, someone from the crowd yells out, "A fugitive! A fugitive!" Uh-oh, I'm in trouble. I think Smith tells the story best from here, though. He later wrote, "I had never heard the word fugitive before. I was pretty scared out of my wits. But a slave had little to fear in a New Bedford crowd in the days of slavery. They all stood aside and let me pass." Many other cities all across the north, he would have been put right back on that ship and sent right back from where he came. There's a bounty on that man's head. There is an owner who's willing to pay an awful lot of money for him. Not in this city. In this city, they welcomed him. Between 1840 and 1860, there are approximately 1,000 free African Americans living in the city. We estimate that there was somewhere between 300 and 700 fugitives being harbored in this city, depending on which years you're looking at. You add that all up, it's a larger African American population than existed in Boston, Philadelphia, or New York City at the time. Basically, the largest African-American population which existed anywhere in the United States outside of the South. Kind of remarkable when you think about it. But there's a problem, right? Think of yourself as a fugitive slave, and you are a woman. You run away, you find yourself in New Bedford. Well, great, I got away from my owner, I guess, but what am I going to do with myself? I have no family. I have no friends. I don't have a place to stay. I don't have a job. How am I going to survive? Well, for many of those women, the answer will be to work in the many boarding houses which would have lined this region. And at our next stop up on top of Johnny Cake Hill, we'll talk a little bit about their story.
We're visiting with National Park Ranger Mark Mello at the New Bedford National Historical Park in New Bedford, Massachusetts. He's sharing stories of New Bedford as a safe haven for formerly enslaved African Americans. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel.
Diagonally, sort of kind of across the street from me, is the Siemens Bethel. Two Hebrew words, Beth and El. Beth meaning house or place, El meaning God. So house or place of God. Basically, it's a non-denominational place of worship. Now, why would you build a non-denominational place of worship in New Bedford? Well, think about it, my friends. You have a lot of young men coming back to the city with a lot of money in their pockets. What are they going to spend it on? Stuff they should not. Namely, alcohol, gambling, and women. Makes Quakers cringe. How could this be happening in our good city? We need to reform these young men. But how do we do it? We have men of all different kinds of backgrounds and cultures, right? I just mentioned that. All different kind of religious and moral backgrounds. How do we reach out to them no matter what their faith is? Well, we build a place that where your religion does not matter. But you can come and you can worship your God as you so choose. Whether you're a Jew, a Muslim, a Christian, a pagan, you can come and worship however you want without being judged. Right there on the first floor, if you were to walk through those doors, there's an area called the Salt Box. It's a makeshift school, rudimentary school. You only learn how to read and how to write. But think about that for a fugitive slave. And for many of these whalers who came to the city, never had any of them, for the most part. Some of them had. Some slave owners had taught them. But most of them had never learned how to read or how to write. I can't help but stand in this spot and look at that building. And it gives me chills every time I think about it. What that building must have meant to a fugitive slave on the Underground Railroad. Not only was it a place where you would not be judged based upon your religion, but it was a place where you could get an education. And what is more empowering than an education? Something special to those men. But back to the boarding house thing. The Mariner's Home, right there, is one of the original boarding houses which was here. Now, as I mentioned, whaling stinks. Not only figuratively, but literally. Whale oil reeks. You're bringing in a lot of it not too far away from here. So this whole region is going to smell awful. So where do you think all the rich folk go? They get out of this region. You can look down upon your assets. You don't have to smell them. So they head up into the city, up the hill, leaving behind many of the old original houses, like the Mariner's Home. That man who I said, Roach, his home. His daughter donates it to the Port Society to be operated as a boarding house. Basically, a boarding house is like a European hostel. Same idea. It's not quite a hotel or a motel, but it's a place where you can sleep. You're going to have to share a room with strangers, but, you know, it's a place to sleep, place to eat, and it'll give you a nice little place to stay if you're a whaler here in the city. But what better place for a fugitive slave woman to work than in those boarding houses? It gives them a job. They have housing. 3 meals a day. What better setup could you ask for coming to this city? So a lot of them will find work in these boarding houses. And most of them will be relatively safe. Relatively. You weren't always safe. And one story is of a young girl named Mary. Mary worked on a boarding house right up here on top of Johnny Cake Hill, which no longer stands. She works there for a little while. That is until her former owner, a Mr. Wim from Baltimore, decides to go looking for her. He gets the deputy marshal down there in Baltimore, comes up here to New Bedford, because that's where he hears that Mary is, figures out which boarding house she's working in. Walks into that boarding house, finds Mary, confronts her, points at her, and says, "You are my girl. I'm taking you back." Put yourself in Mary's shoes. A woman who thinks she's finally achieved freedom. And now here, staring her in the face, is the one man who wants to bring her back into slavery. It's at this moment, though, that the other young women in the boarding house jump between Mary, Mr. Wim, and the deputy marshal, and quote-unquote get into a physical altercation with these two men. Two men are probably twice the size of these young women, and they are armed. Yet these women will get into this altercation long enough for Mary to sneak out the back door and never be heard from again in New Bedford. Or at least they think. Several years later, she'll write a letter to the Republican Standard, the paper here, letter to the editor. And in it, she will write telling us of her story and thanking those women who remain nameless to history for helping her escape from her former owner. Now that may be a great story to some of us, but here's where we have to have a reality check. By the standards of the laws of the 1800s, those women were criminals. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. Think of the wording we're using here. Fugitive. When do we use that wording today? Someone who's evading the law. Technically, by the laws of the 1800s, Mary is the rightful property of Mr. Wim. And anybody who helps her to escape from her rightful property is basically aiding in theft. So by the standard of the law, they were criminals. Were they heroes? That is up to each one of you to decide individually. But one thing is for sure. They were heroes to at least one human being. That was the young girl named Mary. Now, that's what the women were doing. What about the men? What would a fugitive slave who was a man do when he got to the city? Well, I can guarantee you one thing. If there is one place on this planet that your owner will never find you, it's the middle of the Pacific Ocean. What better way to escape than to go away on a whaling voyage? And at our next stop, the Customs House, we'll talk a little bit about their story. I want to point your attention to the building right here. This is the Customs House. It's the oldest still operational Customs House in the United States of America. So it's still doing the exact same thing it would have done back in the days of whaling. Certainly there are customs houses which are older. The one in Boston is. But this one is the oldest that is still in operation. This building was very important for a whaler, though, because you needed something here in order to get on one of these voyages. It's called a protection paper. I want you to think of a protection paper basically as the predecessor of a modern passport. It does the same thing. It says, I'm a U.S. citizen, and in foreign ports, I am protected by the U.S. government. So very important for a whaler as they go and journey around the world, right? Very important, though, too, for a fugitive slave. Is a slave considered a citizen of the United States of America? No. They're a resident, they live here, but they're not a citizen. No citizen could ever be held in slavery. So how do you get around it? Slaves aren't citizens. A fugitive slave gets their hand on one of these pieces of paper. They now have a legal document saying that they are what? A citizen. They now have legal proof that they can no longer be a slave. It's a powerful idea. Would it hold up in a court of law? Depends on who the judge and the jury are. But they do have legal proof now that they can no longer be a slave. But how does someone who's not a citizen get one of these? How do you go about that? Well, there's a couple different ways. One of my favorites is you find a wealthy Quaker merchant in the city, have him walk down here with you, walk through those very doors, walk into the customs official's office, and he walks up and he says something like this. I knew this man's mother from Philadelphia. Wink, wink. This man's mother was free. So what's the big deal? Well, we're dealing with Quakers here, right? When I say Quakers, New Bedford or Guilford Courthouse doesn't automatically pop to mind, right? What usually pops to mind? Pennsylvania, Philadelphia. So guess where these Quakers had business? Down there in Philadelphia. So they're constantly making that journey. Point two, if you were born to a free parent, you too would carry their freedom, especially if it was your mother who was free. You would inherit that freedom. One visitor a couple weeks ago said, well, sort of kind of like an illegal immigrant having a baby here in this country today. Same idea. You would carry the freedom. You carry that citizenship in the country. Not necessarily upstanding stuff, though, right, that these Quaker merchants are doing, right? Did that Quaker merchant know that man's mother? Heck no. He had never met this guy until 2 hours ago. But he's going to do it to help this guy to get on one of his whale ships. Not a one-way street. Not just doing it out of the good of their heart. He's now that guy is going to go to work for that merchant. But it fulfills that very Quaker belief of let's help people help themselves. Funny, when you go down to the Whaling Museum archives, take a look at the African American protection papers. Guess where over 50% of them are from? Philadelphia. There's no way in heck they were all from Philadelphia. But it is proof of what was happening here in this building. There's another way to get a protection paper, though. And that is that if I can pass as a tall man of dark skin, dark complexion, dark eyes, dark curly hair, I can become that man as long as I have money to pay for said piece of paper. Get what I'm getting at here? There's a black market for protection papers, illegal buying and selling of protection papers. So that is what's going on here. And that is how they're getting onto these whale ships, and that is how they're getting out to sea. And like I said, there's no better place to hide than the middle of the Pacific Ocean. He'll never go look in there, I can promise you that.
This was the first of our two-part series about the safe haven for formerly enslaved African Americans who made their way on the Underground Railroad to New Bedford, Massachusetts. Our guest is National Park Ranger Mark Mello, who works at the New Bedford National Historical Park. The books Mark Mello recommends are Fugitives Gibraltar, Escaping Slaves and Abolitionism in New Bedford, Massachusetts, by Catherine Grover, Whale Hunt by Nelson Cole Haley, and Leviathan by Philip Hoare, that's H-O-A-R-E. This program was recorded on September 2nd, 2016, in the Old Town section of New Bedford, Massachusetts. Radio Curious has over 600 archive editions on our website, radiocurious.org, with new editions published regularly. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The phone is 707-462-6541. Christina Onnested and Yuko Kodama are the assistant producers. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.